We begin on the second, the last third of the Bhagavad Gita, starting with chapter 13, entitled The Nature, the Enjoyer, and Consciousness. Then Srila Prabhupada, he introduces the topics of this final six chapters in the purport to the first and second verse of this chapter. Now, starting with the 13th chapter, how the living entity comes into contact with material nature, and how he is delivered by the Supreme Lord through the different methods of fruitive activities, cultivation of knowledge, and the discharge of devotional service, are explained. Although the living entity is completely different from the material body, he somehow becomes related. This also is explained. So then Arjuna, he opens this chapter by asking a question about six different topics. So Arjuna said, "Well, my dear Krishna, I wish to know about property, nature, Purusha, the enjoyer, and the field and the knower of the field, and of knowledge and the object of knowledge." The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "This body, O son of Kunti, is called the field, and one who knows this body is called the knower of the field." So here 6 points have been established here. That is the material nature. It says prakriti, for that which is enjoyed. Then purusha, who is trying to enjoy that. Then the kshetra, the field. Then the kshetragya, one who knows this field. Then the abhyana, means knowledge. And then Gyeya, which means the object of this knowledge. So this is what Krishna wants to know about. So here, Krishna just starts to speak and says that the body, that's the field. And who knows the body, that is Kshetra Gya. So the field is Kshetra, the place where activities are happening. And then the one who knows this field is Kshetragya, one who has understanding of this field. So then, just different points are made about, So then the field will continue here. O Skyna Bharata, you should understand that I am also the knower in all bodies. And to understand this body and its knower is called knowledge. That is my opinion. So Krishna has made the point. That Krishna makes the point that the body is the field. That who knows the body means the living entity. The soul knows the field. So that is Kshetragya. But now he points out there's also Krishna, he is Kshetragya as the Paramatma. He also knows the field. But there's a difference. Here, we know just our body, but Krishna knows all bodies. So there's a difference even in Kshetragya. And so to understand this, to know the body, the soul, and the super soul, Krishna says that is knowledge. So he asks about what is knowledge. So now he's answered, in short, what a Kshetra, Kshetragya, and Jnana. So Srila Prabhupada defines jnana in his purport. Perfect knowledge of the continued constitution of the body, the constitution of the individual soul, and the constitution of the super soul is known in terms of Vedic literature as jnana. This is the opinion of Krishna. To understand both the soul and the super soul as one yet distinct is knowledge. One who does not understand the field of activity and the knower of activity is not in perfect knowledge. So this was stated earlier in the Gita, in the second chapter, to know matter, spirit, and the controller of both. But this is it. So that is called knowledge. So it's the same thing now being presented in a slightly different way, and that we're describing here, the body and the knower of the body. So when we say material nature, it means here specifically the body. We may think, well, what about the whole thing? But we don't know the whole thing. We only know that part of the material nature that we come in contact with our body, either through the eyes, the ears, the nose, the mouth, the tongue, like this. This is how we know this world. So one may feel, what about the whole material nature? But that doesn't actually matter to us. We don't know that. So what we ourselves perceive with our senses, that's what we know as the field. I mean, it is our field of activities. Therefore, the body is actually the field. That's how we are dealing. When the body does not function, we don't interface with the material energy in a very, you know, in a very practical way. We're sick and we just lay in our bed. We don't know what's going on around us. So material nature is there, it's going on, everything's happening, but we have no proper connection with it. So therefore, the real connection is the body. So by the body, we know everything. That's the meaning of what we consider the material energy. That's what we know. So therefore, the body here is becoming more specific. Before, just general philosophy, here we're getting very specific, that the field means the body, because it's the field and where we try to enjoy. We try to enjoy what's going on. What happens is we try to separate it because of so much conditioning of thinking we are the body, so we think we're the body is us, and then there's the material nature. But factually, no, the soul is us and the body is material nature. And this starts the real understanding of Jnana. We're not this body. Therefore, here, this is being presented in this fashion to make it very clear we're not the body. We're the knower of the body, to some extent. We don't even know what the supersoul knows. We don't know how things are going on, what's going on, and all that. The supersoul knows everything. Not only that, he knows what's happening in all the bodies. So then in this, because this is now in the Jnana section, there'll be a few points also pointed out here. That our acharyas are very careful about many of these points, very clearly delineating between impersonal and personal paths. The Shankaracharya, then some of these points, he takes these as the basis of his philosophy. So here it is mentioned that the Shankaracharya and other impersonalists have commented extensively on this verse. They say the word cha means you should know that he who is the knower within the body is also cha, me. Right? The soul is the same as the super soul. Right? But then Vrijan points out, were that true, however, Krishna would be contradicting his own statements in chapter 15, when he clearly makes distinction between the soul and the super soul. The soul and super soul are factually one, as the Mayavadis claim. How could one aspect of the one, which is by definition undifferentiated, give knowledge to the other aspect of the one? How could the other aspect be lacking? How could something undifferentiated even possess an aspect? If both were one, absolutely no differentiation, even in terms of knowing and not knowing, would exist. So that he's pointing out two different chas, two different ands here. I mean, two different selves. So then if you say they're one, then why would the one be instructing the other? If they're the same, there's no need. What would be the lack? There's no lack in Brahman. Brahman is Brahman. So that's his point here. So Srila Prabhupada comments on cha in his purport. The word cha is significant, for it indicates the total number of bodies. That is the opinion of Srila Baladeva Vidyabhushana. Krishna is the supersoul present in each and every body, apart from the individual soul. And Krishna explicitly says here that the supersoul is the controller of both the field of activities and the finite enjoyer. So the cha actually means just all the bodies. And he's saying also that means not only the one that we are in, that supersoul is with us in, but all the bodies the supersoul is in. So therefore, then here we see that this second knower, the second kshetra gya, he knows our body, all other bodies, and he is controlling them plus us, who is the subordinate knower. So then this is the same definition is being maintained, just different wording, that before. matter, spirit, and the controller of both, or chit, achit, and ishwar. So Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur explains here, the body equipped with senses is the facility for material contact and is the so-called field, because it is the ground on which the tree of material existence grows. The jiva who knows the body is called the kshetragya, both in his condition of bondage, when he identifies himself with the body, thinking in terms of I and mind, and in his liberated condition, in which he does not identify with the body or conceptions of I and mind. Like a farmer, the kshetragya is also the enjoyer of the fruits of the tree in his field, as described by the personality of Godhead. The village vultures eat one fruit of this tree, while the forest swans eat another. One who, by the grace of worshipable souls, understands this tree, composed of Maya and appearing in many forms, is an actual knower of the Vedas. This verse means, vultures who live outside a village are called vultures, gridhra, because they seize, I guess gridhra means who seizes, because they seize sense gratification. They are like the conditioned jivas who eat one fruit of this tree, misery. Even if they attain heaven, their experience is ultimately miserable. The swans living in the forest, however, are like liberated jivas. They eat the fruit of happiness. The complete enjoyment of liberation is derived from their experience. Thus, the one tree of material existence appears in many forms as the means of attaining hell, heaven, and liberation. Because it is born from the Lord's external energy, it is called Maya Mayam. By the grace of the worshipable spiritual masters, one is made to understand this tree. Those who are in knowledge of the kshetra and kshetragya actually know the Vedas. So Baladeva Vibhushan explains, this body is perceived by ignorant persons as different kinds of selves. I am a demigod, I am human, I am stout, and so on. Nonetheless, one who knows that in all conditions, sleeping, sitting, etc., the body is separate from the self and is the means of the self's enjoyment and liberation. That person, distinct as the knower of the body, which is his object of knowledge, is called the kshetragya, by experts in knowledge of the factual identity of the field and knower of the field. So that's further. Then Krishna goes on. Text 4. Now please hear my brief description of this field of activity and how it is constituted, what its changes are, whence it is produced, who that knower of the field of activities is, and what his influences are. So Krishna here makes 5 points on this. It means the body, how it's made up, what its changes, how, when, and where the body is produced, the identity of the knower of the field, and the influence of the knower. Like this. So basically he's dealing with the same thing. The body is the kshetra, and then the identity of the knower of the field is the kshetragya, and then the influence. Okay. So now he will discuss the field of activities. That field, text 5, that field, that knowledge of the field of activities and of the knower of activities is described by various sages in various Vedic writings. It is especially presented in Vedanta Sutra with all reasoning as to cause and effect. So here it's interesting that Krishna is starting to explain what he's saying, that this is written in the Vedic literatures, and especially in the Vedanta Sutra. So here, Prabhupada states, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, is the highest authority in explaining this knowledge. Still, as a matter of course, learned scholars and standard authorities always give evidence from previous authorities. Krishna is explaining this most controversial point regarding the duality and non-duality of the soul and the supersoul by referring to a scripture, the Vedanta, which is accepted as authority. Then Prabhupada then presents in his purport about the second chapter of Taittiriya Upanishad, then it explains about the different levels of consciousness. And that then there's two systems that are quoted there. One is called Vyasti, the system in which a person directs his meditation towards the self and thus seeks to understand the absolute by considering himself a fragment of the supreme. Analogously, one can study the nature of the entire ocean by scrutinizing a drop. The second indirect system is called Samasti, in which one studies the entirety of the universe while considering it the body of the Supreme. So then you end up with, so this, the direct method, then this Vyasti, one studies oneself, one's consciousness, in other words, one is aware of one's own, what is happening with oneself. So this, then one sees that there's five levels of consciousness of the living entity. So then we have anamoy, which is dependence upon food for existence. Pranamoy, living symptoms and life forms. Jnanamoy, thinking, feeling, and willing. Vijnanamoy, distinguishing the mind and life symptoms from the self. And anandamoy, realization of the all-blissful nature. So these are all five are progressive developed stages of subjective, individual consciousness. And are also objective manifestations of the Lord's energy, which Brahman, the absolute or the greatest, is realized, even if indirectly or relatively. So now there's different, this very important, if one understands this levels of the koshas, then one can understand so much, practically everything about how material nature functions and how we function within it. Because we're always talking about elevating the consciousness. So the consciousness then falls into these five categories. So then anamoy means we can look at it just as a natural progression in one person's life. We can also see it as a proper progression of the different in a broader sense, you know, social and philosophies and all this. So the first stage, anamoy, is where one experience, where one is, when one basically identifies with the material nature, one thinks one is material nature, pretty much. And for like the small child, that means that everything, you know, is basically something to eat or not to eat. So the whole process of neti-neti, the whole philosophy of anamoy is you take everything and put it in the mouth. And if it tastes nice and seems to be you can bite into it, then it is edible. And if it doesn't taste nice or you can't bite into it, then it is not edible. So this is the basic process that's going on here. So everything, yeah, means the oneness, the here, Krishna mentions the point, the unifying oneness is viewing everything as something to eat. So then that makes everything, creates a particular oneness. So this doesn't make, oh, this is an interesting point, make, there's no distinction between which is alive and that which is not. Can't really tell. You just know whether you can eat it or not. That's all. It means if you start to eat it and it gets up and walks off, then generally, you know, it still just means it's not as easily eatable. Okay. And here he mentions it does not even possess any awareness of its own existence as separate from the existence of all else. Although this self-conception is the most basic form of consciousness, it is nevertheless a manifestation of the Lord's energy. Then, when one comes to the stage of pranamoy, his consciousness advances to an awareness of his own active life symptoms, and he identifies with them. His view of the external world is unified by the principle of maintaining his own survival. In other words, the whole world is just view on how it helps me survive or it doesn't. Like the other one is it's edible, it's not edible. So it, now it's a survival life. So you just see the whole world like that. What helps me survive, what doesn't. And in this way you make your decisions of good and bad. Materialistic human society more or less exists on this primeval level of realization. So this stage is also the Lord's energy. Then in Jnanamoy, One's self-concept expands to awareness of his own thinking, feeling, and willing. One's perception of reality is then based upon and limited by that vision. Srila Ramanujacharya, however, explains that the Taittiriya Upanishad places on the Gyanamaya platform only those civilized human beings who follow the Vedic culture. According to him, this is because one's perceptions and actions must be based on actual knowledge. Therefore, it's called Gyanamaya. Vedic knowledge, to qualify one as Gyanamaya, full of knowledge. These first three stages refer to a living entity trapped in illusion, one who is fully identifies with and is limited by his field of activities. In the fourth stage, the Vijnanamaya stage, the living entity realizes himself as eternal spirit, separate from his gross and subtle bodies. This is the platform of transcendental knowledge. The Supreme Lord is known as Anandamaya, full of bliss, and in this final stage of consciousness, one realizes and identifies himself as a servant of that supreme and blissful Lord. And then Srila Prabhupada writes here. He says here that, before Rujan notes that, thus the Lord expands his energy as the five koshas and provides levels of consciousness to the kshetrigya, means the knower of the body, the living entity, then can get these five different levels of consciousness. Prabhupada writes, to enjoy his transcendental bliss, the Supreme Lord expands into Vijnanamaya, Pranamaya, Jnanamaya, and Anamaya. In the field of activities, the living entity is considered to be the enjoyer, and different from him is the Anandamaya. That means that if the living entity decides to enjoy in dovetailing himself with Anandamaya, then he becomes perfect. This is the real picture of the Supreme Lord as the supreme knower of the field. The living entity as the subordinate knower and the nature of the field of activities. One has to search for this truth in the Vedanta Sutra or Brahma Sutra. So this levels in other places, then it's also mentioned that if one uses the senses, that is fully what one is dealing with. That is how you perceive the world. I mean, it's the small child, then it'll be, you know, just something to eat. When he gets bigger, Pranamoya, he sees that there's other members of the family. Then Jnanamoya, he takes up duties, prescribed duties of the Vedic culture. And then Vijnanamoya, he understands he's not his body. Anandamoya comes to the transcendental platform of understanding his relationship with the Supreme. So like this, this consciousness can develop. But there are those who always predominantly stay on one of these. So anyone who their senses are the main thing for understanding the world, that's Anamaya. So that includes great scientists who just see the material nature as all in all, or those who worship the Vishwarupa. That because all they are seeing is the material world that they perceive with their senses. So it's the lowest level of consciousness. And this is the standard. You'll generally find, especially in the modern culture, this is the standard of consciousness. That is, everyone will say that's perfectly normal. You know, you have to be able to perceive it with the senses. I can't see God, so therefore he can't exist. You can't prove him by some mathematical equation or, you know, find him in a test tube or, you know, some other way of what is accepted. In other words, scientific proof nowadays is purely Anamaya. If the senses can perceive it, we accept it. If the senses can't perceive it, we don't accept it. Or we know something's there, but it's not official. Like, you know, the mind, emotions, affections, you know, all these different things. They know, seem to be exist, there's symptoms that show it, but officially they can't really say what's going on. Because they can't perceive so much with the mind, unless they can turn it into sequences that they can identify with the senses. So if they can get symptoms of the mind, emotions, like that, that can be perceived through the senses, then they'll say, okay, then something. So it's very common nowadays. This is how people work. They like it, it's good for their senses, then it's figured good. If they don't like it, it's not considered good. Do what you like, you know, what we like, our standards, that's all. That's considered very common acceptable standard in the world. But we see that this is the lowest level of consciousness. And higher than this is then someone who is worried about life. Life that they're worried about others. You know, they get into, you know, kind of altruistic work or different things, you know, save, you know, some kind of animal, or they get into ecology, or in some ways that this aspect of life, greater life, or just they're into people, helping people, social workers, their whole thing is helping people. So it's still, it's sense gratification. It still senses sense gratification, but now it's extended. It includes others now. Instead of just being ourselves, now it includes other people in whatever category you like, either a specific category in a community or a nation, or, you know, beyond this, you know, national feelings, community feelings, family feelings. These are all prana bhava. Also in this will come justice, because as soon as there's a community or nation, there must be justice. There must be your economic platform that we accept, okay, you give me this, I give you that. These things are, this is all coming from this platform of pranamoy. Then the yanamoy, it's also sometimes called manamoy, then is the platform of thinking, feeling, and willing. So then on this, then this is regulated. So you basically have three areas that can be there. That is how do you say? Is the platform of you know, some kind of ritual, ritualistic need that is there in the living entity. And this will manifest either as the Vedic culture, or as non-Vedic religion, or as some mental speculation, some mental speculative philosophy or, you know, lifestyle that is created. But Ramanuja points out, since it's called Jnanamoy, it can't factually be, except for the Vedic culture, which is the, how do you say, is the actual platform of knowledge, you know, coming from the Shastra, coming from the Lord, only that can factually be called Jnanamoy. The others are just reflections of that. You know, even though they may be on that platform, we don't consider that real. Just like we may say Brahmavadis are transcendentalists, but we know because they cannot stay in the Brahman eternally. They will fall against the material world. Therefore, in another way, we say they're not transcendentalists. Right? Does that make some sense? We'll say the personalists and the Brahmavadis are both transcendentalists, because they're interested in what's transcendental. They're interested in Brahman. One in the Supreme Brahman, and one in just the Lord's effulgence, the Brahmajyoti. So those who know Krishna, they are actually transcendental, because they can go to the spiritual realm and always remain there. While those Brahmavadis, they may know Brahman, what they're dealing with is factually, because it's not complete in knowledge. It's not complete in its understanding and application. Therefore, their situation on the transcendental platform is temporary. Though maybe a very long temporary, but it's still temporary. Therefore, ultimately they're not counted as transcendentalists. Only devotees actually can know what is going on. Krishna will make that point later in this chapter. So in the same way, as even though, because it's functioning with the mind, it is creating a, how you say, it is creating a whole culture of interaction and rules and regulations for basic upliftment of the human being, then we could say by that definition that Vedic culture, non-Vedic cultures and mental speculations, or Vedic, in other words, dharma, the varnashram, then non-Vedic dharma, you know, world religions, Buddhism, Jainism, all these kinds of things, or mental speculation, somebody has their philosophy, you know, like existentialism or something like that, and from that they base their whole lifestyle, then you could say that they're there. But factually here, Ramanujacharya says, because it's jnana, then the Vedic culture is based on this knowledge of the difference between matter and spirit. though some people functioning within it may not, but the creator who has created the system, Krishna, and the sages who have propagated it and delineated it, they have knowledge. So only it is actually situated on Jnanamaya. The other ones aren't factually, because it won't last. Someone has another philosophy, he won't last on that level. Right? Generally a follower of the Vedic culture will remain there and will gradually progress. Someone who's on non-Vedic or speculative, then they're not going to get very far on this. There's also an interesting point here, because the Mayavadis, it's not, they don't actually get to Anandamoy, which is transcendental. They follow all these rules and regulations very nicely. They know the difference between matter and spirit, which is the next level. But it's still a speculative religion. At that, it's not transcendental. So the next level is then Vijnanamaya, which means under a realization of the knowledge. It means you realize the difference between matter and spirit, between the body, the mind, and the soul. So this creates the Vijnanamaya. Then Anandamaya is understanding our relationship with the Supreme Lord. Krishna is Anandamaya. Anandamaya Vyasa. But so we can understand that we are his servant, part and parcel of the Lord and his servant. Then that is the platform of Anandamaya. So the devotee automatically is on the topmost platform of consciousness, because he understands himself as servant of Krishna. Right? Then within that platform, then we may use so many aspects. So now the point comes as this, is that we see that the first three levels, Anamoy, Pranamoy, and Jnanamoy, are basically dealing with the material energy and duties that are there, engaging the body and the senses and all the social customs and exchange based on the Vedic rules and regulations. Right? So this is what we would call karma. Right? Then, Jnana, what we call Jnana is Vijnanamoy, understand the difference between matter and spirit. Then Anandamaya is transcendental consciousness, where we understand ourselves as perfect, as servants of Krishna. So now, in this, the definition of bhakti, when we're giving, means we can take that someone who understands that they're servant of Krishna, but has not fully realized that, then they're situated on Anandamaya. But they still have the conditionings, means the things that are holding back from fully realizing, is the conditionings of karma and jnana. In other words, these other four lower koshas. So what's happening is Krishna's recommended that someone finds himself in that position. He engages those things for serving Krishna without attachment. Then, because the Anandamoya means serving the understanding we're servant of the Lord and serving the Lord, then since we're not situated on that platform of Anandamaya, because liberation is Vijnanamaya, right? Understanding we're not the body. That's the Brahma-Bhuta platform. Right? So then, this is the stage above it. This is pure bhakti. So we're not fully situated there. So to get fully situated, we engage the karma of these anaprana and jnanamoy in Krishna's service without attachment, with knowledge. In other words, vijnanamoy, knowing we're not in the body, we're different from the mind and the senses. Then that will purify us, and that will bring us to become more solidly situated on Anandamaya till we finally get fixed in that position. Does that make any sense? In other words, there's the theoretical understanding of something, and then the realized. Just like you see, there's the theoretical understanding that we're not, like anyone in the Vedic culture knows they're not the body, but it still is pretty theoretical. Because even though they know they're not the body, they still have so much attachment for it that they're performing karma. Like the Kshatriyas, the reason they can get out on the battlefield and fight how they fight, they know they're not the body. They know that if they die, if they win the battle, they'll enjoy the kingdom. And if they lose, they'll go to the sun planet and enjoy there. So they know they're not the body, so they know that it's not going to, they're not afraid of death because they know that they're not going to die. It's either they'll enjoy in this body or they'll enjoy in the next body. So but we see that attachment for the fruits and results doesn't give realization. Theoretical knowledge is there, and they can practically apply it for their material desires. Right? From Dharma comes Artha and Kama. Do we understand? Dharma is the platform of Jnanamoy. Artha is the platform of Pranamoy. And Kama is the platform of Anamoy. Then from that it goes to Moksha, which is Vijnanamoy. So the Kshatriyas aren't working on that platform. No, they understand. So everyone in the Vedic culture has some understanding of this. Therefore it's considered, this is real Jnanamoy, because everybody has some understanding. Other forms, though they seem to have the meaning, but they're not actually real. You know. Does that make some sense? So what happens is the living entity isn't fully realized on the platform of Anandamoy, or on the platform of Jnanamoy. So he performs these activities of Nishkam Karma Yoga, which engage the karma aspects, the first three koshas of consciousness, and the fourth one, combined together to serve Krishna and establish yourself on the topmost level, the fifth level. So from that platform of understanding we're serving the Krishna, we engage in these other activities, because we haven't realized that yet. As our faith increases and our purity comes, then we, as we become more and more attached to Krishna, then that will be our position. Then we see, as we become more situated, we're totally understand we're not this body, then that means that all those aspects that are dealing with the body, we don't need to perform anymore. Anamoy, pranamoy, manamoy activities, manamoy, Jnanamoy are the same. We don't need that aspect of karma, doesn't need to be performed. Therefore, renunciation of work can be accepted. Right? Because one's situated now as we're not the body. So then, Vijnanamoy, that can be our platform of situation. And we don't have to work. But we see that only factually is realized when you get the full result. When you get the full result, understanding you're not the body completely, you can act on that platform exclusively. So Krishna recommends, in a sense, that's not easy, and one doesn't generally find oneself in that position. Then better to follow the activities of the prescribed duties, right? Of the prescribed duties within our our whatever duties we have, our devotional activities, our what do you call it, Varnashram duties for Krishna without attachment. That will purify us. That will bring us to that platform. Otherwise, we will get stuck. So in other words, we can see we're progressing through that. Someone who is more absorbed in their prescribed duties, though they have understanding of Krishna and they understand they're servant of Krishna, they understand we're not the body, so they have theoretical understanding of the Vijnanamoy and the Anandamoy. But the consciousness is mainly on the karma. So this is the Sakam Karma Yoga. If one comes where one's more on the analytical side, then it will come more to Nishkam. Then when it comes to the platform of where one's come to that Ramabhuta platform, then one technically doesn't have to perform the Nishkam Karma Yoga anymore, because one has transcended that. You know, one has transcended those first three koshas, and one is situated on the fourth. And then by meditation meditation on the Lord, by chanting the Lord's holy name, in other words, just the activities of the Bhagavad Marg, then one can get to fully situated in Anandamaya. But as preachers, we generally continue to perform prescribed duties to set an example. That is what Krishna explains to Arjuna. He says, I do that. I have no duties to perform, but I do them anyway, just to set example. So he's telling Arjuna, you also do like that. So we see how these five koshas fit in with this whole system of karma yoga, both the sakam and nishkam, and then the jnana yoga, the jnana yoga meaning just the emphasis is the nishkam karma basically is jnana, is buddhi yoga. It's just where the emphasis is. Then the bhakti is where we're actually situated on the transcendental platform as Sri Krishna. Is that understood? So now another aspect of this is, since a devotee does understand his position, means we look at in the Vedic culture that others get. So by understanding that, even though he's using these other aspects for elevation, this is an important aspect. Therefore, bhakti includes those. The process, this will be coming up now. Yes, let's just continue here. So then, then Krishna continues with text 6 and 7. So now he's starting to give, more definition of the kshetra. He's mentioned one who knows the kshetra and kshetra-gya, then he has knowledge. So now he said he'll describe the field of activity, how it is constituted, what its changes are, whence it is produced. So that will continue. Then after the knower of the field of activities and what its influences are. So now he's describing the material nature. The five great elements, false ego, intelligence, the unmanifested, the 10 senses and the mind, the 5 sense objects, desire, hatred, happiness, distress, the aggregate, the life symptoms, and convictions. All these are considered, in summary, to be the field of activities and its interactions. So we have 24 elements that are described there. And then Bhujan points out 7 qualities of the mind derived from interactions with the 24. So these 24 elements, that is the field, that's the body. Then, depending upon how things are going, according to our desire, we have our desire, what we want, how we want to try to enjoy these 24 elements. Then that, from that gives hatred, happiness, distress, the aggregate, the life symptoms, our convictions. But it's all based on these 24 elements. So this is then the explanation of the, what the influences are. So these are the, these are interactions. So Prabhupada mentions here, the body is the representation of all these factors, and there are changes of the body, which are 6 in number. The body is born, it grows, it stays, it produces byproducts, then it continues, then it begins to decay, and at the last stage it vanishes. Therefore the field is non-permanent material thing. However, the kshetra-gya, the knower of the field, is proprietor, is different. So this, Bhurjan's pointing out here that everybody has their allotted amount of this 24 elements, what they get and which way is put together. And then someone can do more things, less things, like we mentioned, as an earthworm can't read or write or run around or jump, like that. But then, another animal can do more. Human being can do more. So depending upon what is given, then we have sort of kshetra is based on one's karma, one's desire. Then one will accumulate the particular kshetra. That will be discussed in future chapters. Okay, then now we get to what is actual knowledge. Means the Now there's 2 aspects of knowledge. We have sambandha, meaning the living entity, the Supreme Lord, and the material body. Then you have the application of this. How now we have this, what are we going to do with this knowledge? How are we going to use this knowledge to free ourselves from the material nature? So this is the other aspect of knowledge. So the one is called sambandhagyan, when we know the elements and the relationships, and then abhideya, that means we know how to apply that knowledge to free ourselves, to actually perform, you know, devotion activities and to free ourselves from the material bondage. Saint Krishna here in text 8 through 12. Humility, pridelessness, non-violence, tolerance, simplicity, approaching a bona fide spiritual master, cleanliness, steadiness, self-control, renunciation of the objects of sense gratification, absence of false ego, the perception of the evil of birth, death, old age, and disease, detachment, freedom from entanglement with children, wife, home, and the rest, even-mindedness amid pleasant and unpleasant events, constant and unalloyed devotion to me, aspiring to live in a solitary place, detachment from the general mass of people, accepting the importance of self-realization, and philosophical search for the absolute truth. All these I declare to be knowledge, and besides this, whatever there may be is ignorance. So this is very important. Now he's... Yeah. Okay, let's bring out some points that we discuss. Is that... So this is the process on how we're going to get... attaining the knowledge. It's knowledge itself, but it's the process of attainment. So according to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, of the 20 items mentioned here, 17 apply to both the jnani and the bhakta. So the last two, accepting the importance of self-realization, adhyatma jnana niyatvam, and philosophical search for the absolute truth, tatva jnanartha darshanam, are technically only for the jnani. Because the accepting the importance of self-realization, the devotee already has done that. And philosophical search for the absolute truth, the devotee already knows what is the absolute truth. He's heard from authorities. And the jnani must endeavor for this. So these are specifically for the jnani. And then the point, constant and unalloyed devotion to me, is the sole quality specifically for the devotee. Then all of the qualities come to a devotee who is exclusively endeavors for constant, unalloyed devotion. So one who has that quality is endeavoring for that, constant and unalloyed devotion, then all these other qualities come. They'll come along with the process of following this path of knowledge. So now we see that it's a very interesting platform here. Humility, pridelessness, non-violence, tolerance, simplicity. If those are there, right, and this comes by understanding that we're not the body and all these things. In other words, when you have knowledge, you have sambandhagyan, then that's going to create an understanding. If I understand I'm not the body, I'm the soul, and then there's the super soul, who's knowing of all bodies, he is the controller, I am not the controller. And what does that do? That creates humility. Right? Because I'm humble. I know I'm just a spirit soul. Then we have the aspect pridelessness. We know I'm not the doer. Krishna is the doer. I'm very small. He's very great. Non-violence. Because then I see everything is Krishna's. So I only do what is to be done for Krishna. I do everything for Krishna. So then we're not violent. We're working for the upliftment of the soul. So there's no violence there. Violence means that we don't understand the relationship that there's a difference between the body and the soul. And we're endeavoring for sense gratification based on the fact that we think we're the body. And tolerance, we're able to tolerate because we know we're not the body and this body is only interacting with the material modes of nature. Simplicity. Therefore, we don't have material desires. So we don't need much, just whatever it takes to live. That's all. Just whatever we basically need, that's all. So we see when we have that fundamental knowledge, then all these things manifest. So these are the how one gains advanced knowledge. By having a little bit, we see these start. And by the greater that we have the knowledge, the greater these become. Then another aspect we can see from this is that the basic elements, at least the potential of humility, pridelessness, non-violence, tolerance, and simplicity, is required to approach a spiritual master. That's the next point, approaching a spiritual master. So now you've heard this, now I want to know more. Right? And we want to know more. Like Shraddha, we hear something. Sadhu Sangha, we associate with the devotees. We hear more about this, we develop these qualities more, we become more purified. Then we seriously approach one of the sadhus of the Sadhu Sangha and take initiation. Then that brings us to these next points. Then we'll be trained in the cleanliness, steadiness, self-control, renunciation of the objects of sense gratification, absence of false ego. Now before it was pridelessness, but now it's absence of false ego. Means now with more knowledge we've gained from approaching, then this comes to a greater level. It means we don't identify now. Before us, maybe we're very gentle. We've done something wonderful. We know we've done something wonderful, but we're a little less, we're not so proud. But here's no false ego. We don't at all identify that we are doing any of this. Very, very clear here. Perception of the evil of birth, death, old age, and disease. Detachment, freedom from entanglement with children, wife, home, and the rest. Even-mindedness amid pleasure and unpleasant events. Constant and unalloyed devotion to me. Aspiring to live in a solitary place. Detachment from the general mass of people. So all these things will just naturally develop once one's taken shelter of the spiritual master. And as long as you keep constant and unalloyed devotion to me and to Krishna as the prominent feature. So do we see this difference in it? So this is knowledge. Krishna says this is knowledge. Whatever, and besides this, whatever there may be is ignorance. In other words, all these are connected to Krishna. Because Krishna says, whatever is connected to me has substance. What is not connected to me has no substance. So in other words, these points are someone who is connecting themselves to Krishna. These are qualities and understandings that they will have. And these are methods by which one can gain that understanding of Krishna. So it all fits very nicely together. So the at one point, the knowledge, the theoretical knowledge, becomes practically applied. That's Arjuna's point. When he hears that there is a transcendentalist, then he wants to know how does he apply his understanding. He is transcendental. He knows he's not the body. He knows he's the soul. He's eternal. So Arjuna wants to know, how does he act then? How does he deal? How does he deal with the material energy? How does he deal with others? How does he deal with all the difficulties that come to him? You know, happiness and distress, all these. How does he interact with the material nature, with other living entities? These points are made. He asks that. Because in being intelligent, he knows it has an application. Has an application. So then, this is the application here. This is the process. So in Vedic knowledge, you have to have process. You have to have sambandha, a relationship, understanding the relationship, what actually the elements are. Then, one must have the process by which one is going to, and then the goal, and then the process to get that. So sambandha, abhideya, prayojana. One needs all these three. So by having the basic knowledge, then acting on that knowledge, one comes to the platform of the ultimate goal. Yes, Srila Prabhupada explains the relationship between the process of knowledge and the field of activities. This process of knowledge is sometimes misunderstood by less intelligent men as being the interaction of the field of activity. But actually, this is the real process of knowledge. If one accepts this process, then the possibility of approaching the absolute truth exists. This is not the interaction of the 24 elements as described before. This is actually the means to get out of the entanglement of these elements, of those elements. So this process of knowledge is not material. Therefore, we're not interested in humility or pride. This is separate from Krishna consciousness, because then that's just interaction with the modes of nature. So even though it looks the same, like devotees are supposed to be very, they have 26 qualities. And humility, pridelessness, non-violence, all these things are their qualities. But if you endeavor for them separately, those are material qualities. Right? Then that's just part of, you know, your happiness, your distress, your desires. Your desire to be nice to everybody. It makes you happy being nice to everybody. In other words, you situate yourself very nicely in pranamoy. Pranamoy basically means you're a nice guy. Right? You're nice there because pran, you accept life. You always consider other people, what they may think, and this and that. But you're only considering their sense gratification. You're not distinguishing between them as the body and them as the soul. Right? What is what we call the body and who is the actual owner of the body? That knowledge is not there. Therefore, it's said that Nishkam Karma Yoga is not that you just take the karma or the anaprana and jnana moy platform and engage that in the Lord's service. Because that means you would be performing, engaging the senses and the emotions in the Lord's service through prescribed duties. But one wouldn't actually know who he is, so he's doing it in ignorance. It's not in knowledge. So the platform of Anandamoy means pure, Vishuddha Sattva, pure goodness. Right? So goodness means the platform of Vijnanamoy, understanding the difference between the body and matter and spirit. Therefore, we situate ourselves in knowledge. And from there, then we can come to the transcendental platform. So Nishkam Karma Yoga means that you have to be performing prescribed duties with knowledge. Otherwise, if there's no knowledge, it's sentiment. Thus, Prabhupada's statement, religion without philosophy is sentiment. And then if you have philosophy without religion, it's mental speculation. Because we see here, this is the perfection of religion, Krishna says. This is perfection of religion joyfully performed. Why? Because you're performing all your activities for Krishna. So you have the philosophy, you know it's for Krishna, you know we're not the body, we're not the material nature. We're servant of Krishna. And in that, I perform my prescribed duties, I perform my activities. So it's a perfection of religion. Because it's religious activities done in transcendental knowledge. It's connected to Krishna, yukta. Otherwise it's not. So if we just say, oh, devotees have to be more nice to each other, more kind to each other, but that's not knowledge. They have to be, but based on what platform? Based on the platform of knowledge of we're not the body, we're the soul, qualities of devotees, the actual Vedic culture and what that exchange means between personalities. You know, what is actual relationship? What is actual exchange? We just sentimentally say everybody should be nice, but what is nice? Everybody can have a different idea what's nice. You're only nice to me if you come up to me and give me some money. You don't give me money, you're not nice. Right? Or someone else, it's like, give me so many things you want, but that's not really nice. Real nice is you sit down and spend time and talk with me and, you know, we get to know each other as people. That's real nice. You know, someone else's, you just give me something to eat. That's nice. So, I mean, everybody can have their platform. They can decide what they call nice and what they don't call nice. Right? So, therefore, when there must be a standard, and that standard is set by God. Standards means religion. Means standards means that which controls our activities. So that is religion, and religion must come from God. So then we get something nice. We get something that actually works. Otherwise, it's sentiment, bus. Means, yes, devotee is humble, prideless. He is very kind to everybody. But coming from which platform? understanding is not the body, understanding the philosophy, understanding the process, and applying that process, then he's very nice. But if we make the extra separate endeavor just to be nice, but it's not in relationship to the philosophy or the prescribed duties, then what is it? Right? If it's not in relationship to prescribed duties, which come from the Vedic literatures, the Vedic culture, and it's not being done with the knowledge, the transcendental knowledge, then it's not, it has nothing to do with karma yoga. Right? And it has nothing to do with jnana yoga, and it's nothing to do with bhakti. So it's just, it's not even prescribed duties, it's just the level of pranamoy, be nice to each other. Which is the modern concept, that's considered a very elevated concept, you're just nice to everybody. And generally if you're very strong, religious, all that, then that's considered a little higher, but very rare, very few people consider it nowadays. Or you may be considered a religious fanatic. But generally, everybody will accept that someone's real nice, cares for others, all that. That's a very elevated platform in a society that's just based on eating, sleeping, mating, defending. So where the whole society is just into anamoy, someone who's on pranamoy is considered very elevated. But the Vedic culture, I mean, Krishna's laughing at Arjuna for just being situated on jnanamoy, just on the Vedic culture. And he's saying about taking care of the family traditions and all these things, and Krishna's laughing at him. Because he's saying that without any knowledge, jnana, and without connecting it to Krishna. So if Krishna is going to laugh at Arjuna because of that platform, taking the third level of consciousness without connecting to the fourth and fifth, how is he going to appreciate the second platform? So in other words, this is a science, and we have to know how to do it. It's not just something. We have to understand where does the humility, how do you show humility? There's a way to do that. The Vedic culture shows us. How do we show pridelessness? The Vedic culture shows us. So these things, it's all very nicely connected. It has a great philosophy to it. We have to understand it. So sentiment alone will not solve the problems. It will not solve. That was Arjuna's point. Religion without philosophy. That was sentiment. But at least it was religion. Just being nice is sub-religious. Therefore, sub-religious principles are not considered actual jnana. Ramanujacharya points it out. If it's not based on Vedic principles, then it's not actually jnanamoya, even though it seems like a religious process. It's lower. So he doesn't recommend it to you. Then Krishna goes on here. So now he's going to explain the object of knowledge, or the jnaya. Right? Now Krishna has described basically the kshetra jnaya. In this last verse, what is jnana? I mean, previous verses, what is jnana, meaning the sambandha side of it. And then in this 8 through 12, the abhideya, or the application of it. Now the sixth point that he made, the jnaya, the object of knowledge. Okay. I shall now explain the knowable, knowing which you will taste the eternal. Brahman, the spirit, beginningless and subordinate to me, lies beyond the cause and effect of this material world. Everywhere, so here is, here Prabhupada points out, the description of Brahman mentioned in this verse is in relation to the individual soul, and when the word Brahman is applied to the living entity, it is to be understood that he is Vijnana Brahma, as opposed to Ananda Brahma. Ananda Brahma. Ananda Brahma is the supreme Brahman, personality of Godhead. So, So you have the super soul and the soul. So the knowable, therefore, is Brahman. Where you can actually know. Then Krishna goes on to make some points here that will be difficult to read without the lights. Is this building connected to the general?
Yeah, the second general.
Oh, right back. Okay. But in other words, this whole, that's the whole, one of the main points, actually, it's interesting, of the importance of the Gurukul system of education, is that that is the whole, one of the main thrusts of Gurukul, is to understand these five different levels of consciousness. Because then, in the house, the general tendency is the student, the child, you know, specifically the son, just takes everything for granted and doesn't think for even, you know, a portion of a nanosecond about anything. He just runs into the house, gets something to eat, plays, sleeps, runs out. Never thinks. But when one goes to the Gurukul, because he takes everything for granted, when one goes to the Gurukul, then one has to think. Because then the situation is different. Everything is not just taken for granted, because the bodily familiarity is not there between the teacher and student like it is between the parents and the child. But the rasa is the same. It's still the vatsalya rasa. But the vatsalya rasa of the teacher is in a superior position, because the same care to benefit the dependent is there, but without the gross bodily attachment that gets in the way of actual correct training. Right? It becomes very difficult for the mother and father to train the child because of the attachments. The child does something wrong, very hard to say, don't do this, because of the attachment. But the teacher can just say. So this is the essential element. But, you know, that is the point. So the whole aspect in the Vedic culture of the Vatsalya Rasa, you know, whether it's the parents, whether it's the teacher, whether it's the leaders, you know, like the king, is to act for this benefit of the dependent. It's to train the child in transcendental knowledge. That is the main element. Because it says one shouldn't become any of these unless one can save the dependent from death. So that means you're only saved from death when you actually understand who you are, what the body is, who the Supreme Lord is, and what's the relationship, and how to engage in devotional activities. So the whole emphasis will be put on this. So this five koshas is a very essential element in the Vedic, the Vedic knowledge. Therefore, it's brought out so much. The Taittiriya Upanishad, the Anandavali, is specifically dealing with this, which is where Prabhupada is quoted from. So Krishna goes on to explain here just what is the point. Now he goes on. Now he's describing the supersoul. So the knowable means the knowable is the soul and the supersoul. So here he's, the first one is, he's described Brahman, or the living entity. And he's subordinate to Krishna. Then, here, he mentions now he's talking about the Supreme, the Supersoul. 14. Everywhere are his hands and legs, his eyes, heads, and faces, and he has ears everywhere. In this way, the Supersoul exists, pervading everything. So then, there's a point comes out here. So then, in Prabhupada's purport, he strongly makes the point that this is the super soul, not the living entity. But then some will try to make it that this is the living entity, the impersonalist and all that. So in the Bhagavatam purport, he mentions that one can look at it this way. This is in 2.2.1. Report. those who want to understand it in this way can, but by this, in this way, he says, the kingdom of God is unlimited. Therefore, the number of assisting hands of the Lord is also unlimited. The Bhagavad Gita 13:14, which is this verse, asserts that the Lord has his hands, legs, eyes, and mouths in every nook and corner of his creation. That means that the expansions of differentiated parts and parcels, called jivas, or living entities, are assisting hands of the Lord, and all of them are meant for rendering a particular pattern of service to the Lord. But still, it's in relation to the Lord. The Lord's everywhere, so living entities are everywhere assisting. So in this way, then, you end up with so many hands everywhere. If one wants to see it from that perspective, it can be said. But otherwise, specifically here, Krishna's talking about the super soul. Because he says, in this way, the super soul exists, pervading everything. Then, continuing in 15, the super soul is the original source of all senses. Yet, he is without senses. He is unattached, although he is the maintainer of all living beings. He transcends the modes of nature, and at the same time, he is the master of all the modes of material nature. So the supreme truth exists outside and inside of all living beings, the moving and non-moving. Because he is subtle, he is beyond the power of the material senses to see or know. Although far, far away, he is also near to all. So this point being brought out here is that by the senses we cannot know the Lord, because he has no connection with the material energy, no senses of material energy. So only by hearing with devotion can we, from transcendental sources, can we understand. And he continues, although the super soul appears to be divided among all beings, he is never divided, he is situated as one. Although he is the maintainer of every living entity, it is to be understood that he devours and develops all. He is the source of light in all luminous objects. He is beyond the darkness of matter and is unmanifested. He is knowledge, he is the object of knowledge, he is the goal of knowledge, he is situated in everyone's heart. Yeah, so then Prabhupada quotes, he mentions many verses here to substantiate that this is establishing the super soul, not the soul. So his point is he's divided. Many think he's divided, many super souls. No, it's only one super soul. He's situated in everyone's heart, but it's the same person. So he knows everything that's going on. If he was different persons, then he wouldn't know. How would he be omnipresent and all-knowing? Because then each one has their field of knowledge. But he's just situated in all these places. Example is given, there's one sun, and then you have many pots of water. And if you look in each pot, you'll see a sun. There's only one sun. Okay. And he is the source of all light, the source of light in all luminous objects. So then, okay. Now he describes, so this is the what is knowable, meaning the soul and the super soul, this is knowable. That this is called a jnana, the object of knowledge. Then he will describe the qualifications of one who wants to understand these things. Thus the field of activities, the body, knowledge, and the knowable have been summarily described by me. Only my devotees can understand this thoroughly and thus attain to my nature. So even the Brahmavadis can't fully understand. This is the point I was making before. We'll call them transcendentalists. We'll say they've come to this platform, but factually, unless they're devotees, they haven't actually come to this platform because it doesn't last. So only the devotees can actually know all these things. They don't know. The Brahmavadi just knows the soul and he knows the body, but he doesn't actually know the super soul. So his knowledge is not complete. Only a devotee can know this, because he knows Bhagavan, so he can understand Paramatma and Brahman. But those who are just into Brahman can't actually understand the whole picture, because Krishna is controlling and running. He won't understand. You know, he's working on without enough elements to make a full understanding. Prabhupada Prabhupada confirms this point. The Lord has described in summary the body, knowledge, and the knowable. This knowledge is of three things: the knower, the knowable, and the process of knowledge, and the process of knowing. Combined, these are called vijnan, or the science of knowledge. Perfect knowledge can be understood by the unalloyed devotees of the Lord directly. Others are unable to understand. So he says body, knowledge, and knowable. And he says this knowledge is of three things. The knower means the individual living entity in the super soul. The knowable, which is the living entity in the super soul. And the process of knowing means how the living entity can know about the Supreme Lord and himself. So now Prabhupada summarizes all this in his purport, what's been discussed up to now. Now to summarize, one may understand that verses 6 and 7, beginning with Mahabhutani and continuing through Chaitanadriti, analyze the material elements and certain manifestations of the symptoms of life. These combine to form the body or the field of activities. And verse 8 through 12, from Amanikvam through Tattvajnanartha Darshanam, describe the process of knowledge for understanding both types of knower and the field of activities, namely the soul and super soul. Thus three items have been described: the field of activity, the body, the process of understanding, and both the soul and the super soul. It is especially described here that only the unalloyed devotees of the Lord can understand these three clearly. So for these devotees, Bhagavad Gita is fully useful. It is they who can attain the supreme goal, the nature of the supreme. The nature of the Supreme Lord Krishna. In other words, only devotees and not others can understand Bhagavad Gita and derive the just been described up to now. So these are very essential elements. Because when we say, okay, now we want to perform our activities, we want to come to the platform of devotion, then we're not on that platform. We need to come to the transcendental platform, so we're going to engage our activities in Krishna's service with detachment. But we have to have knowledge, so this is the knowledge that Krishna's talking about, the detailed knowledge. First you have to know what is the body, because you have to act without attachment. Who are we? That means we're detached if we know we're not the body. If we think we're the body, we're attached. If we think we're the doer, then the ego is there. You know, we're attached to the results because we did it. But if we understand it's not, the modes of nature are, we're desiring modes of nature of carrying it out, the Lord's sanctioning it, then we can function without this kind of attachment. So now, the first two points that Arjuna asked about Prakriti and Purusha, now Krishna will describe in the next some verses. Text 20. Material nature and the living entities should be understood to be beginningless. The transformations and the modes of nature are products of The transformations and the modes of matter are products of material nature. Prabhupada explains here. Actually, the living entity is originally the spiritual part and parcel of the Supreme Lord. But due to his rebellious nature, he is conditioned within material nature. It really does not matter how these living entities or superior entities of the Supreme Lord have come in contact with material nature. The Supreme Personality of Godhead knows, however, and the Supreme Personality of Godhead knows, however, how and why this actually took place. So here Prabhupada points out, it really doesn't matter, because Krishna mentioned all the knowledge and what is knowledge, and he didn't explain how we got here. Somehow or another, strangely enough, he left it out of his list of 20 items that are important for going back to Godhead. So here the point is if you know we're not the body, we know the super soul is there, then, and the relationship, then that's real knowledge. Otherwise, it's not. So why we came to this material world doesn't have actually any benefit. because it's not explaining any of these things. Right? It's not explaining the relationship with the Supreme Lord. Right? So Prabhupada explains the point, because of our enviousness, we came. So that's the connection with the Supreme Lord. Became envious of the Lord. So then we turn from the Lord. Then we get into material existence. So now, if we understand that that's how we got here, then the mechanics of it, that's not necessary. Just like if we know that someone says, well, how did you get here? I came by car. Now, does that, now, then you can understand, okay, I can take the car and go back. And that will work for me. I will get from Calcutta to here, from here back. And now if I say, no, 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 I have to understand which place you got the car from, how the, what kind of model is it, what, how it works, you know, is it petrol or diesel, you know, how many spark plugs, and, you know, what was the timing on it, and, you know, how many valves and how many cylinders, and then, you know, what speed you were going and who was driving, and, you know, how old was he and what did he have for breakfast, and, you know, like this. That has nothing to do with it. All you have to know is that there's a car here, you get in it, you go to Calcutta. So we were envious of Krishna, we came here. We give up that envy of Krishna, recognize him as the supreme, us as the servant. In other words, understanding who is the kshetragya, and understand we're not the body, which we're thinking we are. Then we can go back to Godhead. So that's knowledge. That's what Krishna says. All this other stuff is just waste of time. So here it points out that the transformations are the modes of nature and the products of material nature. So the living entity and the Supreme Lord are changeless. The material nature transforms. But because we identify with the material nature, therefore we think we are transforming. But we're not. So Krishna's pointing this out. He's just shown that Prakriti and the difference. 21. Nature is said to be the cause of all material causes and effects, whereas the living entity is the cause of the various sufferings and enjoyment in this world. So this is an important point, that the living nature creates all these different things. But the living entity, he makes for the various sufferings and enjoyment. Right? Because you have the situation, but we decide that this is enjoyable or not. So we create what's enjoyable or not. Right? We may say, oh, this situation is not enjoyable. Some people think it's great enjoyment. Right? If we may be out of cold wind and all that, we'll say this is not enjoyable. But some people go outside in the morning, a nice cold breeze, wind, and they'll breathe very deeply and say, ah, good, nice, bracing, you know, cool air. And they're very enthusiastic. So to them, that's great enjoyment. Right? So they've decided that this is enjoyable. Someone else has decided this is not enjoyable. So material nature, she's the cause, she's all material causes and effects are there. We desired it, then there's a cause that will have to be created, and that will give an effect. We have a desire for an effect. So Maya has to act in such a way to cause that effect. So she does all the cause and effect. And because we've desired it, when it happens, we think this is very nice. And if something other than this particular effect comes, we say it's not nice based on the desire. So we create what is happiness and distress. So Krishna explains more here. The living entity in material nature thus follows the ways of life, enjoying the three modes of nature. This is due to his association with that material nature. Thus he meets with good and evil amongst various species. Now, and then Krishna here explains now the actual proof. In other words, he's explained Prakriti, and he's explained the so-called Purusha. He's a living entity due to his desire to enjoy, then he is supposedly the Purusha, the enjoyer. But it's all due to his mental concoction. And sometimes he enjoys, sometimes he suffers, because he is at the hands of the material nature. Because with the enjoying spirit, then comes the other side. There's always the downside, birth, death, old age, disease. Then Krishna explains here, 23. Yet in this body there is another, a transcendental enjoyer, who is the Lord, the supreme proprietor, who exists as the overseer and permitter, and who is known as the Supersoul. Right? So here, the Supreme Lord, now the relationship. He's the proprietor, the overseer, and the permitter. So this is the relationship. He actually owns the material. It's all his, living entities. And he is the permitter. He oversees and he permits. So this is the relationship between the Lord and the living entity. He sanctions it. You know, Prabhupada explains this. The fact that every individual living entity is eternally part and parcel of the Supreme Lord, and both of them are very intimately related as friends, but the living entity has the tendency to reject the sanction of the Supreme Lord and act independently in an attempt to dominate nature. Because he has this tendency, he is called the marginal energy of the Lord, of the Supreme Lord. The living entity can be situated either in the material energy or in the spiritual energy. As long as he is conditioned by material energy, the Supreme Lord, as his friend, the Supersoul, stays with him just to get him to return to the spiritual energy. The Lord is always eager to take him back to the spiritual energy. But due to his minute independence, the individual entity is continually rejecting the association of spiritual light. This misuse of independence is the cause of his material strife in the conditioned nature. The Lord, therefore, is always giving instruction from within and from without. From within, he gives instructions as stated in, from without, he gives instructions as stated in Bhagavad Gita. And from within, he tries to convince the living entity that his activities in the material field are not conducive to real happiness. Then, quoting Krishna, "Just give it up and turn your faith towards me, then you will be happy," he says. Thus, the intelligent person who places his faith in the Paramatma, or the Supreme Personality of Godhead, begins to advance towards a blissful, eternal life of knowledge. So now the result of fully actually understanding this relationship. 24. One who understands this philosophy concerning material nature, the living entity, and the interaction of the modes of nature, is sure to attain liberation. He will not take birth here again, regardless of his present position. So Prabhupada explains here. A clear understanding of material nature, the super soul, the individual soul, and their interrelation makes one eligible to become liberated and turn to the spiritual atmosphere without being forced to return to this material world. So by knowing this, then this is the result. One becomes freed from the contamination of the material world. One is freed from the material bondage. It's interesting that we're farther from the temple than in the other room, but the kirtan is louder here than there. I think it's just the speakers are exactly pointed here. One should note that when the person leading the kirtan is twice as loud as the whole mass of a few hundred devotees responding. It's just like in a sabji. You have ghee and you have chili, and they are balanced. How much ghee you put chili to balance that so you can digest it. So if you don't put enough chili, it's very rich and heavy. You just eat it, it feels too heavy and oily. If you put the right amount, you don't notice the ghee at all. It just feels just very natural. If you put too much chili, it tastes hot. Right? So a good cook knows how to balance these two. So in the same way, a good both kirtanier and a good, you know, sound man knows how to balance these two. So the purpose of the mic is so that the devotees who are responding can hear what he said. It's not that he drowns out everything and becomes, you know, like this. What to do is a very esoteric point, not well known. So then text 25. And then what I find most amazing is many can't understand any advantages to grass huts. The grass huts you might even have, you don't have echo, like in the room. It's very hard to concentrate with an echo. You don't have any noise that's there. Outside you can have kids playing drums and it doesn't bother you because it's acoustically dead. So all the noise gets absorbed. So it's very, very good for teaching and learning. Very, very good medium. So 25. So then here Krishna then describes other ways that one can understand this knowledge. 25. Some perceive the super soul within themselves through meditation, others through the cultivation of knowledge, and others through working without food and desires. So we see these just described, you know, same processes that he's been describing before, karma, jnana, and yoga. So perceive the super soul within themselves through meditation, the Astanga yogis, others through cultivation of knowledge, then the Shankya yogis, like practicing Kapila Muni's direction. And then others through working without food of desire, Nishkam Karma yogis. So the same principle is being given there. So Srila Bhakti Vidyabhushan says that such persons may seek philosophical knowledge or meditate, but their primary means of understanding the super soul is detached work. Krishna has extensively discussed all these three paths in the first six chapters. So even though one may use these others, he says his point is, that's right, starts earlier, means that all three aspects are there in the process. All processes have all three aspects. They all have work, they all have knowledge, and they all have meditation. But if the primary emphasis is just on meditation, it's called Astanga Yoga. If the primary emphasis is on knowledge, then it's called Shankha Yoga. And if the main emphasis is on detached work, that's the primary way they understand. In other words, all these three will give you knowledge of the super soul. Right? In this combination, it's just where you put the emphasis. So if it's on prescribed duties, detached work, then it's called Nishkam Karma Yoga. So that is the thing. We all are doing the same thing. But if one connects this very nicely with Krishna, then it's all known as Bhakti Yoga. Though it may be using these mediums. Right? Using the medium of karma, jnana, and yoga. And then he says, if you can't do any of that, right? Again, there are those who, although not conversant in spiritual knowledge, begin to worship the Supreme Person upon hearing about Him from others. Because of their tendency to hear from authorities, they also transcend the path of birth and death. So this is very important, just by hearing. That's why it's saying, Krishna is saying to Arjuna, touch Srinu, you hear. And it's mentioned in the Bhagavatam, just by hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam, then so many bad things become reduced in the heart. So this point is there. Hearing, therefore, becomes most essential. So even if we can't engage very nicely in all these, by hearing, we still will advance. And they also transcend the path of birth and death. So this is very good. Then, 27. O chief of the Bharatas, know whatever you see in existence, both the moving and non-moving, is only a combination of the field of activities and the knower of the field. So whatever you see is all material nature, the body, and the living entity, the soul, super soul. So here Baladeva explains that Prakriti and the Jiva have been united since time immemorial. So then Krishna starts to explain their separate individual existence in this next verse, 28. One who sees the super soul accompanying the individual soul in all bodies, and who understands that neither the soul nor the super soul within the destructible body is ever destroyed, actually sees. He sees the body is destroyed, but the soul and super soul are not. and that the Supersoul is always there. 29. One who sees the Supersoul equally present everywhere, in every living being, does not degrade himself by his mind. Thus he approaches the transcendental destination. So when you see the Supersoul everywhere, you see the soul, the Supersoul of the body, then you don't become disturbed by the situation, because you understand it's just what is there is going on by material nature. You see something you like, don't like, and it's all going on by material nature. So because the soul is there, the super soul, then you see this, then one doesn't become disturbed. Because we think we're the body, someone else is their body, then when we see things, we're either attracted, repulsed, all these different aspects. Thirdly, one who can see all activities are performed by the body, which is created in material nature, and sees that the self does nothing, actually sees. So the body is carrying out, we are simply desiring, and then it happens. When a sensible man ceases to see different identities due to different material bodies, and sees how things are expanding everywhere, how beings are expanding everywhere, he attains to the Brahman conception. Then those with this vision, those with the vision of eternity, can see that the imperishable soul is transcendental, eternal and beyond the modes of nature. Despite contact with the material body, O Arjuna, the soul neither does anything nor is entangled. The sky, due to its subtle nature, does not mix with anything, although it is all-pervading. Similarly, the soul situated in Brahman vision does not mix with the body, though situated in the body. So this is telling how one can be in that position. That one is within the body, but just like the space is everywhere, right? There's so many things there. Space is, you know, in this room, but the space doesn't connect itself with this room. So in the same way as the soul is in the body but doesn't connect itself with the activities of the body, because they are just being carried out by the modes of nature. O son of Bharata, as the sun alone illuminates all this universe, so does the living entity, one within the body, illuminate the entire body by consciousness. Then here now he summarizes the whole chapter in this final verse, text 35. Those who see with eyes of knowledge the difference between the body and the knower of the body, and can also understand the process of liberation from bondage in material nature, attain to the supreme goal. So Prabhupada sums up the main points and his purport in this. The purpose of this 13th chapter is that one should know the distinction between the body, the owner of the body, and the Supersoul. One should recognize the process of liberation as described in verses 8 through 12. Then one can go on to the supreme destination. One can understand that this body is matter. It can be analyzed with its 24 elements. The body is the gross manifestation, and the subtle manifestation is the mind and the psychological effects. And the symptoms of life are the interaction of these features. But over and above this, there is the soul, and there is also the Supersoul. The soul and the Supersoul are two. This material world is working by the conjunction of the soul and the 24 material elements. One who can see the constitution of the whole material manifestation as this combination of the soul and material elements, and can also see the situation of the Supreme Soul, becomes eligible for transfer to the spiritual world. These things are meant for contemplation and for realization, and one should have a complete understanding of this chapter with the help of the spiritual master. Since the body is the gross manifestation, the subtle manifestation of the mind and psychological effects, and symptoms of life are the interaction of these features, how we interact with. In other words, the gross and subtle body, how they react with each other. That is the symptoms of life. questions on this? It's fairly, I mean, fairly clear point Krishna's making is that one must, means the person who can become liberated, who knows what is the body, which is made up of the material elements, he knows who is the living entity in that body, and he knows the supersoul. And he knows the process of, so that's knowledge. And then he knows the process of knowledge, which is that verse 8 to 12, this humility, pridelessness, nonviolence, tolerance, simplicity, approaching a bona fide spiritual master, constant and unalloyed devotion to me, like this. So when you know that, then you can become liberated. So one who sees with this vision, actually, then he gets free from bondage in the material nature and attains the supreme goal. Yes.
The purpose of the process of knowledge has to come to the Vijnana platform, the Brahmaputra platform.
That's the main basic, but we see that here is that there's the element because you know the Lord.
Yeah.
See, for the jnani, that would be all the thing, because he doesn't engage in constant devotional service. See, is that you're running a semi-parallel processes that are going on. You have the process of this, devotional service and all these aspects that are going. But you can use these processes either to elevate yourself in Krishna consciousness or to elevate yourself on the material platform. Material or, you know, what do you call it? Just up to the level of Brahman. So the karma, jnana, and yoga can be used just for the purposes that they want there. At the same time, so you can use them, the proper use of them is to come to the transcendental platform. So if it's done with knowledge of the super soul, that's what he says here, and also sees the eyes and knowledge the difference between the body and the knower of the body. The knower of the body is the two, the soul and super soul, and can also understand the process of liberation from bondage. So that means he has the whole thing. Then he becomes liberated from bondage and material nature, and attains to the supreme goal. So the Brahmavadis, they'll only get liberation from the bondage of material nature. They won't get the supreme goal. They'll call the Brahman the supreme goal because they'll read the same literature and take these same points, but they'll only interpret them with partial knowledge. Right? So they only get a partial result. But here he's making the point of both. Is that if you do it in this way, you will not only become freed from material nature, in other words, the negative is removed, but then the positive is established and you go to the supreme goal. Yes.
So the in the process of knowledge there are certain like prohibitions, don't do this, and there's certain things that should be done. Is it correct to understand that from the jnani point of view, he's becoming free from the modes of passion and ignorance by the prohibitions and becoming attached to the mode of goodness. By coming free from the modes of passion and ignorance, then he develops knowledge and detachment, by which he can come to that ground and path. And then for the devotee, the prohibitions and the things to do and things not to do then are to help us remember Krishna and never forget him. So the things not to do is so that we don't forget Krishna. And the things to do is so we can remember Krishna. Then by doing that, we are also becoming free from the modes of passion and ignorance and coming to the mode of goodness. Is that a proper understanding? Or are we actually transcending the mode of goodness? We're like removing the mode of passion and ignorance and we're transcending goodness.
Means it's all going on at once. It's just that. The devotional process, you know, Krishna and the Acharyas, they count all these other processes as part of the path of bhakti because it's for the purpose of bhakti. Right? You know, something being done for someone else's for a particular cause is also counted as part of that cause. So the karma, jnana, and yoga that is used by the devotees, then that is also part of the devotional process. But, like you said, it's coming from down rather than going from up. See, one is going through the yoga ladder. The indirect method means he's going through karma and he has the goal of knowledge. Right? Then he does that, and then he becomes detached from his work. And then he starts to gain knowledge. Then you can take up the path of, and it's not necessarily that you even know it's there. You may not make that proper connection like that. But if you do make, then you start on that path of jnana. And then by performance of that, you have a goal of coming to the Brahman platform. That. And then yoga, you have the idea of coming to the platform of understanding. The idea at least proper is the super soul. But if not, then they also go to the Brahman.
So for the devotee,
those things are happening, but because they already have the ultimate goal there, they don't have to worry about the slowness of this indirect path. For them, the path is direct, because Krishna is the goal, they just go right through these things. So how much they need to spend time in each of these levels, that much is spent, and then they just move through. While for the karma, the jnana, the yogi, they very elaborately get into it. Means we touch karma, nishkam karma yoga, deal with the activities of karma, just how much we need. We don't take more. You know? And the aspects of jnana, we just take what we need, we don't take more. You know? And the aspects of meditation, chanting, we just take that aspect. We don't take all, you know, sitting under a tree and all these different things. We just take what we need of that. And then, but the goal is always Krishna, so it's the direct path, because you see Krishna, so it's direct. The other ones don't know the ultimate goal is Krishna. So they go through. The karma yogi gets detached and gains knowledge. The jnana yogi then gets more knowledge and comes to the Brahman platform. The astanga yogi then comes to the platform of also understanding Brahman, or comes to the platform of understanding the super soul. It basically brings him up to the platform of the super soul. But he doesn't know what to do once he gets to the super soul. Then one takes up bhakti. Right? But here it's just like clean cut. You're on one path and that's it. And then you're on the next path and then that's it. And then you're on the next path. So basically, for someone on the indirect, until they actually realize the super soul, you know, start meditating and realize the super soul, they don't take up bhakti. So therefore it's indirect. You know, it's very slow. Well, for the devotee it's direct, because he just immediately takes up the desire to serve and please Krishna. Though he may not be on that platform of realization, it's theoretical for him. In theory, he understands Krishna's position. And in theory, he understands he's not the body, all these different things. In theory, he understands that devotional service is the best. But he starts to perform that. From that, he does get a little taste. A little, you know, all these different things that are there. Faith increases, the taste increases, the attachments increase for Krishna. Though it may be small, but he uses that medium of karma in the beginning to bring himself up. Then he comes to the platform of mainly the jnana aspect is more prominent, then the platform of yoga is more prominent, and then it comes to pure devotion. But the whole time through, the devotional element is there, the devotion, the goal and everything, so it's called the direct process.
And they don't want to describe simply by hearing.
Yeah.
Does that mean simply by hearing? Let's say someone is a very simple person, he cannot understand the mechanics of the whole process, but he just simply hears Bhagavatam.
Yeah.
Then he doesn't have to understand the mechanics of the process of karma, jnana, and yoga. He just simply hears that and comes to that.
Basically. I mean that he doesn't, may not understand, but he hears something, and in that hearing you're supposed to do something. So he does those things. He may not understand fully why it works, this, that, but he does so with faith. And by that association, by performing, you know, because he's doing it, he knows that one should have the goal of Krishna and this and that. He's doing these things. So he advances also. It says here that, he says they also transcend path of birth and death. they worship the Supreme Lord. That's the point. They hear and begin to worship the Supreme Lord. So because they're hearing from authorities, they become free from the path of birth and death. So that's a very strongly part of our process anyway. You know, hearing and chanting. Because you see, Shravanam, Kirtanam, Smaranam. So those are the essential elements. And those are the elements that we see is that, you know, the top platform of yoga is always chanting and always meditating on the Lord. That, so hearing and chanting and always thinking of the Lord, that's the most essential process. That's the Bhagavat Marg. But because of our conditioned nature, then the Pancharatrik Marg helps us. Yeah, prescribed duties. The sadhana, the whole sadhana bhakti and all that is that we're doing it because it's rules. We're supposed to do it. The shastra says we do it. See, then it comes to the next platform is we do it because we like to do it. Then ultimately comes the platform we do it because Krishna likes it. That's when it comes to the platform of actual devotion. Krishna likes it like this, and that's exactly why we're doing it. You know? Like that we may like or may not like. Doing it. Some of us say, well, I'm doing it because Krishna likes to do it, but you're doing those things that you like to do. But here it means Krishna likes it, so if I like it or not, it doesn't matter. You know? I've heard from the Shastras, okay, from the authorities, that Krishna likes it. But it's not because the Shastras have said it that I'm doing it, it's because Krishna actually likes it that I'm doing it. So it's just a slight change in the mentality. You know, in one's inspiration. So in the beginning, then the sadhana is like, you know, will be more on the rules and regulations, and then after time, it'll be because we have a taste for following and performing these activities. Is that making any sense?
Because we are desiring. So material nature is hygiene, like it's an example of when we go outside, it's very nice, cool breeze. But if I'm in a room, it's very pretty hot. Then I feel like I should feel to have cool air. Then I should not think that I should feel, get air sometimes. I should not even think of that.
No, it's not a matter. See, this is. We have to be very careful about these two aspects. See, when it says that one's not endeavoring, one just sees the material nature as carrying these things out. But that is being carried out from a platform of detachment. You know? So it's not that one is disturbed by it's hot or cold. So you're presenting that I'm disturbed by hot and cold, but I understand it's the material nature, so I don't get involved. But here we're talking about it's not perceived as hot and cold. It doesn't bother us. It's hot, it's cold, but it's not a matter of disturbance. Right? It means for doing the service, if you need to make some adjustment of that, then that's fine. But if not, service goes on. Like if I'm in the kitchen and cooking and it's summer and it's hot, okay, if I can open a window, if by opening a window make it a little less cooler, it'll be a little easier to work. I won't sweat so much into what I'm cooking or, you know, like that. The brain works better. And then I'll do it. And if not, it doesn't really matter. It's not an impersonal thing. So we don't want to throw it into a personal thing. The point is that one just doesn't notice. Right? Does that make any sense? It doesn't make any sense. Let's say we're in the kirtan, right? The kirtan's going on, we're standing on the side, it's a hot day, right? We got this fan turned on, and we're standing as close as possible to it. We're not worried so much about singing or dancing. We're just worried it's hot and I want to stand next to the fan. Right? So this means we're very much affected by heat and cold. And to the point where we're not even really understanding our service. But now, if somehow or another we get inspired, you know, either on our own, someone comes in and, you know, drags us into the kirtan and we're dancing like a madman, we're hot and sweaty, but we couldn't care less that we're hot. Somehow or another, 2 minutes before, the hot is completely keeping us. I can't chant, I can't dance, it's just too hot, I can't do this. It's unfavorable, right? The next moment we're dancing and sweating like anything, but we don't care because we're absorbed in our service. So these things don't actually get in the way. If they do, you try to make an adjustment to make it run better. If it adjusts nice, fine, because Krishna is the sanction. If you desired that it didn't happen, Krishna didn't sanction it. You know, it means the service can go on without it. Some things did learn. So it's just it's basically the perception. So it's not impersonal that we, you know, it's hot, it's stuffy, we can't think, we can't read, but no, it's the modes of nature, so I'm not going to get involved, you know, like that. But we're getting involved because we're affected. So the body's affected. You just go, it's the body's affected. What's the problem in opening the window? If it's not us anyway, what's the problem in opening the window? But when we open the window, then we don't go, so nice now. And just like we don't get disturbed that it's so stuffy, we notice it's stuffy, it's difficult to read, we're falling asleep. We open the window, then we don't fall asleep. Then we can read. We're only worried about doing our service. Right? So we have to be very careful to avoid the thing that, you know, spiritual advancement means some tough, nasty, you know, difficult thing, and the more difficult, the more austerity and physical disturbance there is, and the more advanced it must be there. You know, that has nothing to do with devotional service. Point it is that we're not disturbed by it. It's not that it's hot, so we're disturbed. Right? It's just hot. If we can do our service, the service goes on. If it's difficult to do the service, we try to create a coolest situation, because it's the body we have to work through. And if the body can't function, then what's the use of, you know, all our tolerance of the heat? You know? But if we find that it's a disturbance because we like it or don't like it, that's not the consideration. Does that make any sense?
In Pranama level, one is expected to be non-violent and nice to others. But when Arjuna wanted to withdraw from war, Krishna didn't approve of it. That in a particular situation, how one can decide whether to be violent or non-violent, how to get that answer?
That's a matter of prescribed duties. A kshatriya, his duties, means the duties that are given that are on the platform of Jnanamaya, is that he must protect the citizens, and if need be, if after you're in the political chain of activities, you've first spoken nicely, if that works, then fine. If that doesn't work, then you offer positions and this and that. If that doesn't work, then you do beta. You split the people. Means those who support, you bring them, you know, to your side. Those that don't support, you make them on the other side. And then, if that gets rid of the problem, fine. If not, then danda. Then those who oppose, then you take care of them, you punish them. So that's just the duties. That's how a kshatriya works. So for a kshatriya, fighting is not violence. That's their prescribed duty. Right? Because they're doing it out of duty for the, it's not violence, because the body is, that's already been explained before in the second chapter. The body is not killing. It means the soul is not killing, just the bodies are interacting with the other bodies. So we're not the bodies, so it has nothing to do with that. So it's prescribed duties. We have to see things according to prescribed duties.
look in the present society, what is our Varnasrama harmony is not exactly as it was before. So how can one decide what is this gift? Because no pure Kshatriya is there, no pure Brahmin is there.
Yeah, so what has that got to do with us? What does that have to do with us? It's just like this. If there was a pure Vaishnava king sitting on the throne, would you still be eating and sleeping? Yes or no?
Yes.
Okay. Now, if we don't have a pure Vaishnava king, we have some rascal nonsense sitting on the throne, are you still eating or sleeping? Yes or no? So, why is it that we cannot perform our duties because someone else is not doing theirs? Right? It may make it more difficult, but somehow or another, all our activities, eating, sleeping, all our senses, everything, you know, wife is cooking what we like to cook today, it doesn't matter who's sitting on the seat. But, you know, we're getting our, you know, whatever, our rice and dal, how we like it cooked. So how is it those can go on, but the other can't go on? So prescribed duties are, you know, it's very obvious. If one's a grihastha, then there's duties to perform for that. Depending upon how one, you know, maintains oneself. You know, he works for others, he has his own business, he himself is organizing the community, or he's, you know, teaching or preaching or performing deity worship like this. Then there's duties that go with that. So understanding our own nature, performing our own duties, doesn't have, it makes life easier if everybody else is doing, but the point is material nature is not easy in the first place. Even if whole Vedic culture is running, it doesn't mean that there's not disturbances. Right? Disturbances are always there, that's the material world. So never be perfect. It just is a different matter whether it's more difficulties or less difficulties. So if the society isn't set up, it makes it more difficult. If it is set up, it's a little less difficult. But that's about it. Right? But otherwise, we can still, as an individual, do ourselves. This is the whole, basically, my understanding is the whole failure in applying the Varnashram, basically within a society, is most that I've seen are unwilling to start with themselves. Their whole idea is let everybody else change, then I can fit in. No, is if each individual tries to follow their proper activities and perform that, understanding who they are and what their relationship with others, then automatically, if you're doing what you're supposed to do right, then the other person, when he has to do what he does and interacts with you, it'll work because you're doing what you're supposed to be doing. And that other individual is doing what they're supposed to do, so when you interact with them, it'll work. Because somehow general idea is when you sit down to discuss this, I'll always start talking about the individual. And hands immediately go up, but that's all right, we change ourselves, but what about everybody else and the management, the GBC and the sannyasis and this one and that one? It's everybody else in the universe but themselves. Because the living entity doesn't want to surrender to prescribed duties. In fact, prescribed duties means restriction. Yeah? And because we're coming from an impersonal background, we don't understand that restriction creates roles, right? I have a particular role, therefore my relationships are restricted. If I expand or lessen the restrictions, the role changes. So because of impersonal upbringing, then therefore we don't understand, we rebel against prescribed duties because we think that they think we're this restriction. They cramp my style. I'm an individual. But I don't want to act in any role. I want to act freely, whatever I want, at any time I want, however I want, and no one should say anything. And so simultaneously, then I am supposed to be protected by the administration and this and that. But I don't want to follow those rules of one who is protected, meaning being, you know, submissive and this and that. And then when something happens I don't like, I go out and get my stick and I'll go up and catch whoever the authority is and hit him with that stick, which is not my role. So I won't perform any role. I just allow my mind to do whatever it likes. And so therefore there's no relationships. You just have a conglomeration of minds bumping into each other. Right? Because as we see, Gita is saying, it's only desires, that's all that's happening. That's all that's happening. So living into these desires, the modes of nature are carrying it out. So if you desire to work within that system, that the material nature carries it out properly, then it gets done. We can try and have all kinds of desires how we want, but material nature works in the way it works. You know, we can decide we're going to keep some fire under our pillow or something like that. It doesn't work like that. Fire works like fire. You learn to work with fire as fire can be worked with. Where do you learn that? By from the mind? Oh, from authority. Or you can use the path of experience. You know, the indirect path of the impersonalist. You just go through neti, neti, neti. But the easiest is to learn from authority how to deal with fire. Then, if you have your desires to deal with fire in the proper way, then your results are going to be much better. If I don't hear from authority, I make up my own idea, and I want to bring fire under my control, it won't happen. Because the living entity cannot control the material energy. Material energy is controlled by Krishna. Krishna sets the rules. Krishna has established Varnashram Dharma. That's human life. So, and devotees are humans. They follow that because it's Krishna's system. Right? But they don't make the mistake that the fruits of the system are for them to enjoy. Therefore, Krishna says, detached work, Nishkam Karma Yoga. And then, when we come to the platform of where we're more situated in knowledge, then we don't care, it doesn't matter to us anyway. You know, if it all doesn't matter, then why, so we say, oh, we don't care for that, we're just devotees. Then why do we care so much for so many things? How the management is set up, who does what, this, that, who's in charge, who's got what facilities? That means we're interested in prescribed duties. Managers should be like this, right? The devotees should have this facility. That's all prescribed duties. So now either we make it up ourselves or we follow what Krishna gives us. That's what we're left with. And if we don't care, you know, who cares who's running the place as long as it runs? As long as Mangal Arti's there and I can go to it, the Bhagavatam class happens, I can go and listen. I have some service to do for Krishna. You know, we're more interested in the philosophy, the understanding, like that. One may say, well, I can't do my duty, but that's also, it is decided by us. Our happiness and distress, what makes us happy, what makes us distressed. You know? Yeah. The material world is not functioning any too great. You know, it's not like that. Perfection. And there they're working without knowledge. So if we have knowledge, then material nature won't bother us. It's not a matter of material nature is going to go perfect. Material nature just won't bother us. Right? We'll come as close as possible of adjusting with the material nature that it functions as close as properly. But beyond that is we ultimately just have to not be disturbed by it. So that is the point. There's no material perfection. We cannot for ourselves decide that spiritual perfection means material perfection. Spiritual life means everything is materially perfect. No, spiritual life means I'm not disturbed by the material nature, whether it's perfect or not. Right? So if we're actually detached, then we don't worry about it. If we are attached, then we should follow Krishna's system for attachment. Then we can give up attachment. Otherwise, we won't give up attachment. You know? We won't give up.
Make sense? I think having vision if some influential person, powerful person says that, no, you should not be here. But it's my duty here, and I'm having all rights. Then how I act?
Planning on setting up a business or something.
Yes.
So, but I mean, is this affecting your chanting or reading? Or you're chanting in the temple and somebody comes along and says, this is my spot.
Means congregation yogis, they have some business. But if power, person is in power and influence, he comes and says, you should not be here no more. But yeah, he has got all rights to.
That's just the way the world is. That's why we've taken up devotion.
And how should I act at that time?
But it's a pretty theoretical situation, because unless there's more detail, how do we know? I mean, if you're a brahmachari working in the library and you're running a business, and then somebody comes along and says, you're not supposed to be doing business here, I want this spot, then maybe Krishna's telling you as a brahmachari you should be involved in business.
Srigrihastha. He doesn't even have any source, for example. He's merely from that one.
Is there any specific relevance? It may have, I'm just kind of like missing the thread.
Thinking if he goes back to Hyderabad, starts a temple there.
Yes.
And it's a little bit separated from ISKCON.
Uh-huh.
He likes to be ISKCON, isn't he?
Uh-huh.
And ISKCON authorities there oppose that he's opening that, and they're in a conflict about Shri Kulina's situation.
Aha, oh, I see. I have seen through to the inside point.
That is not true.
All these things are individual, so unless you know the situation and all that, it's very hard to say. Because they're, see, what we're here, the real thing is the kshetra and kshetra-gya. The position of the body and the knower of the body, right? This is the discussion that we're on now, and the super soul. So now here, this business we have, but it just depends. What is our situation? Can we get something done in another way? Do we have people we can go to and mention something? The point is we endeavor, and you know, it's like we're doing something, and it's working nicely, we're being Krishna conscious, everything is running smoothly. But then we run into some difficulty. One, we learn that the material world is not a place meant for a gentleman. Then, but if we're dependent upon that for performing our prescribed duties as a grihastha, then we may make some endeavor to try to adjust that difficulty. Right? We may approach other people of influence in that who are favorable, and then see what we can do. But ultimately we have to leave the result up to Krishna. We cannot think that I am doing this, I am doing this, I'm doing that. Krishna's already said the interactions, someone's influencing and being influenced and all that, that's all the modes of nature. So we just are desiring to remove this problem, and then the modes of nature are arranging for methods which we can try to influence ourselves, the other person under the influence of the modes is making their influence. And then we leave it up to Krishna, because he's been a sanction. And then depending on who attacks, we go on. Because when we work, especially when we work more in the realm of karma, then facilities come depending upon what we're thinking. If we're more dependent upon Krishna, then it's how he likes to give. If we're dependent upon ourselves, then we're the doer, then we're dependent more upon our actual material abilities that have been awarded by karma. So at some point we have to start to surrender and be be attached to Krishna. In any case, it's all going to be, has to be given up anyway. Right? This was, if one's prescribed duties to do business, one does that. You know, and does whatever one has to do to maintain businesses. But that's the secondary point. The main point is understanding how, you know, Krishna is working, our working, our position. But how, as businessmen, what is my duty? Besides making money, my duty is also to give in charity. You know, I have up to today never heard one question on that. You always hear the question on what to do if my prosperity is hampered. Right? One, why would God do that to me? And two, you know, how am I supposed to act? But we never ask, well, what am I supposed to do with my prosperity that I'm making? How am I supposed to engage that in Krishna's service? How, as a businessman, do I balance with my chanting and hearing and serving in the temple and all that? We generally don't hear those questions so much. You understand?
So how much percentage of charity you should give?
That you heard, you should always try to give. As much as possible. Something, best is all, at least give 50%. That means your profits. In other words, one gives what one can. By understanding these principles, and one doesn't live extravagantly. This is a whole different discussion. This is a discussion of Varnashram. I was only making the points of Varnashram to show how it fits into the process. This Nishkam Karma Yoga means that you're engaging your prescribed duties. You know, this is not a forum for a discussion of Varnashram as such. That's another forum. Because then you have to have the whole background of that to understand how to make these decisions.
Devotee and it doesn't matter whether it is in material world or spiritual world. One devotee asked, he said to Prabhupada, that, I want to serve life after life. And Prabhupada said, I know you have to go back to God.
No, I just said, so that person said, Prabhupada, we just want to serve you life after life. And then Prabhupada said, oh, you mean I have to stay here to accept your service? That's what he said. Prabhupada said, you know, you do this, you go back home, back to Godhead. And the devotee was so enthusiastic, said, no problem, we want to stay here and serve you life after life. So Prabhupada said, so that means I have to stay here in this material world to accept your service, because you want to serve me life after life. That's what, that was what the actual point was.
And you said that means I have to come back also.
Yeah, it means Prabhupada has to come back. Prabhupada was saying himself. The devotee is saying, we want to serve you, Prabhupada. Life after life. It means here in the material world. You know, and that then what that means is Prabhupada has to be here life after life to accept that service. So what does that mean? Yeah, they're making Prabhupada come back just because they want to stay here and serve him here. You know, if Prabhupada wants to go somewhere else, you want to serve Prabhupada, you go wherever he is. And if he says you go back home, back to God, then he's also from there, you can serve him there. Are you tuning into this, or are you sure? thing that's coming up, that's the one that talks about the banyan tree. That's the 15th chapter. That's where it starts out about the banyan tree. When it says no separate endeavor, then one has to also understand how that word is used. We say we're trying to cut down with the sword of knowledge, but at the same time as these attachments, we're not trying to get rid of by a separate endeavor. We have to understand what separate means. So Kapila Muni explains that the mood of a separatist means you do something separate than what is the Lord's directions or what is being done for the Lord's purpose, the Lord's desire, the Lord's pleasure. Right? Means Krishna and the Acharyas give us direction. We follow that, then that's not a separate endeavor. That's direct endeavor, direct method. If we have a different idea than that, how we're going to do it, that's a separate endeavor. You understand? Like that. So if following the instructions that Krishna gives us, if following the instructions of the Acharyas, then that's not a separate endeavor. But if we make up our own path, our own process, that's a separate endeavor. Or we have desires other than what Krishna is explaining. That's a separate endeavor. Does that make sense? So Krishna is giving us the knowledge by which you can cut down this banyan tree.
He uses the word separate interests.
Separate interests. So whenever you see like this, you see that certain words are always used. They're used in that particular way. So not having a separate, it means separate interest. So that's not a separate, that means meaning of not a separate endeavor. We don't try to do, like Krishna says, you do these things in this way. You do it like that, and that's the process. We understand the difference between the body and the soul, and that's knowledge. So that automatically is going to develop then these other aspects of knowledge, humility, pridelessness, and stuff. That's how we're going to get humility and pridelessness, is understanding we're not the body. And becoming detached from the body, understanding some modes of nature carrying things out. Then, automatically, come over here, what do you care? Right? As long as you think I'm doing it, then great attachment is there. So that endeavor, pride is there. But as soon as you understand, I'm not doing it, it's just the modes of nature carrying out, I'm not the body, then humility just comes. You know? It's just like the point is we're eating. And while we're eating, then the hunger is just going away. You don't have to separately, other than the process of eating, you don't have to separately endeavor to get rid of the hunger. So by following the process, it goes away. But you still have to follow the process. Some think, well, no separate endeavor means I don't endeavor at all. Right? Because we understand endeavor, because that's what we've been doing this time of morning. It's endeavor. We don't understand separate. So no separate endeavor. By following devotional service, these qualities come. Because in devotional service, we have to behave properly with devotees, the proper Vaishnava etiquette is there, you have to understand the philosophy. We try to apply that philosophy in our life. So that is the endeavor. Separate endeavors that, you know, we think that by some other method, we are going to develop these qualities. Does that make some sense? No. It means bhakti yoga. It's not that we are adding more jnana than bhakti. The bhakti yoga means that that's there. We use that. It's just like to cook. See, it's just like this. We can only offer pure bhakti to Krishna. Right? But now, how are we going to show that pure bhakti? We're just going to sit here and just emanate bhakti? Right? Let's say we want to cook for Krishna. Krishna eats the bhakti. But how did he prepare that bhakti that he's going to eat? You go into the kitchen and take pots and pans and sabjis and all this thing, which are all just made out of the material elements. And your consciousness that you do it, that's what makes it bhakti. Right? So that's the point, is that the understanding of Krishna, the activities done, the remembrance of Krishna, that is all included in bhakti. You're going to perform an activity, you're going to have the proper understanding, you're going to be thinking of Krishna, and you're going to try to do it for his satisfaction, his pleasure. Therefore, because the ultimate goal is pleasing Krishna, it's called bhakti. Though we may be using the technical methods of karma, jnana, or yoga in the performance of those activities. You understand? Just like, let us say, if we are not a good cook, then we're going to use a recipe book. If we're a better cook, we don't use the recipe book. We're still going to be using the same pots and pans. Right? But what changes is our understanding of the process. In other words, our jnana is more. But it still is just our bhakti is going to be there. So someone situated in the platform of bhakti has the most knowledge. Because he understands Krishna means you understand everything. And his meditation on Krishna is complete. His knowledge of Krishna is complete. His activities are totally done for Krishna without any attachments. It's complete. But unless we're on that platform, then we may concentrate on one of those aspects with the idea of doing it for Krishna. Because that's the path. So whether we're at the beginning of the path or the end of the path, it's still the path. And we move on that path according to how Krishna feels. So therefore it's not a separate endeavor. Bhakti includes these things. It's not something separate. Because if we look at it, so the point is bhakti is the whole process. And then if we say, well, we just do bhakti, we don't care for any of that, then we have to ask our question, am I on the platform of pure, unalloyed devotional service right at this moment now? And if the answer is no, then that means that we have to take advantage of these mechanical systems to get us to there. After she heard from Haridas, she sat down 3 lakhs a day. She never worried about what she was going to eat, this and that. She just chanted. You know, Narada Muni doesn't worry about what he's eating. He just travels. As the purport of Prabhupada says, when a sadhu gets hungry and there's nothing to eat, he just drinks water. And for 2 hours, you won't be thirsty. I mean, hungry. And after 2 hours, when you get hungry, you drink more water. So then, in this time, I think it was either when Narad Muni came to see Yudhishthir, or Narad Muni came to see Maharaj Pashinabhartishat. One of these, where Narad Muni came to instruct the king. Unless it was it wasn't Chittaketu. And he hadn't eaten for 3 days. So he had been drinking water like this for 3 days. You know, that's what's preparing water, nothing to eat. Doesn't worry. Like that. Then that's, you do like that. You know, it's practical. I mean, it's a process. But if you find difficulty with that, then you absorb yourself in understanding that you're not your body, and that we're in the position of the Supreme Lord, so we can understand the difference between material nature and ourselves. Because if we can't sit down and chant all day and concentrate on Krishna means we still have some identity with material nature. Otherwise, we wouldn't care about eating, sleeping, and all that. We know we're Brahman. And we know the Lord is the supreme goal. We'd always be thinking of Him, chanting about it. But if we can't do that, means there's some material attachment, some material connection. So then we can just sit down and absorb ourselves in the knowledge. You know, about Krishna, about the process of the material world and all that, and understand the difference between us and the material nature and Krishna's position. And we can do that all day. Right? But if we find we can't do that, and the mind wanders and into this and that, and eating, sleeping, and all these, then all those things, the senses, have to be regulated, which means prescribed duties. Right? Which means then this nishkam karma. Performing this prescribed duties for Krishna's satisfaction without attachment. So we're still doing devotional service, but we're just doing it on that level. We find we can't do that because we have so much desire, then satkam, karma yoga. We do our activities and we give some of the fruit to Krishna. Like that. So, but it's all the same path. It's just where we're situated today. The reality of that, not all this, we chant Hare Krishna, we don't care. Fine, we don't chant Hare Krishna, we don't care. We need to sit down and start chanting. Let's see some serious chanting. We won't see any, you know, talking about this and that. We won't see any issues. We won't see any fighting over prasad. We won't even see bothering about prasad. If it comes, you'll take it. If it doesn't come, you don't. You know, but reality is reality. Krishna's talking reality. What he's saying here is the way people see. You know, he's saying he sees with equal vision. He sees with equal vision. But etiquette-wise, he doesn't deal with the Brahman like he deals with the dog. But he sees that the dog is soul with super soul, and according to his desire, the modes of nature are carrying out, and he's doing dog activities. But because he's identifying as a dog, then we, as a person, have to have a relationship. So according to our prescribed duties, when we act, and according to their prescribed, you know, duties, they act. So etiquette remains. But it's just a vision. One is not power. It's just like you're guiding a bull. Take the bull out into the field. It's not because you're angry with the bull that you whack him with a stick. Bulls just don't understand anything else. You want him to go to the right, and he sees some grass on the left that, you know, belongs to somebody else's land he can't have, he'll go that way. You tell him not to go that way, he'll still go that way. You get out the stick, and then he'll go the way you want. Just the way you deal. It's not that you have to be angry and you hate the bull, therefore you get out the stick and whack him with a nose. No, it's just, he only understands that. So the etiquette must be maintained, whatever it is. So the sage deals, he sees the Brahman, the cow, the elephant, the dog, and the dog eater. It's all, the super soul is there. There, Brahman, it's all just being carried out by the modes of nature. It's all going on. in all these different forms, and that is just simply the desire to live in it. So it's all happening like that. But he's going to deal with each one of them differently. Right? If he's preaching, if he's not, then he doesn't even bother. It doesn't matter. You know? But if he's going to preach, somehow or another, where he relates to the world, then he's going to deal with them each according to their position. His prescribed duties are there.
You mentioned it before in the Maitravana Ashram class, where our kid, when he's small, he doesn't bother to think because his mother just does everything he needs. But when he goes to the Gurukul, at that point he starts to think. Last time you said that, it really struck me because I had that experience also. I was separated when I was about 4 years old, my mother. And like it's exactly from that time of separation. I remember this thing, I remember the actual, the time of separation. The actual thing that happened during the separation and you know, the months that followed. But from that point on, I can start remembering, you know, not the detail, but I actually start remembering. Before that, I can't really remember anything. But from the point, from the very point of separation, it's nice how you explain it. More in the ashram. He starts thinking for himself.
That's the whole point of it. Is that the specifically the boy is learning how to separate himself from all these things. And the nature is just they won't, because the mother's so expert, she takes care of everything. So he never even thinks about it, that there is, you know, that there is anything else to do. So as long as he's known, mother's taking care of everything, and it all goes on, he never thinks himself. But the point is, at one time, he's got to be a mature adult. He's got to be the one thinking how to take care and organize and this and that. So if he stays with his mother, he just doesn't learn that. You know? And then when he grows up, he's always with the mother, then the mother does everything for him. So then, and it's one-sided, you know? So it's a one day. Two are there, of course, but it's as far as desires go, it's pretty one-sided. The kid wants, and the kid gets, because of the mother's affection, she gives whatever. So now the boy is attached to the mother, but as he grows up, then kind of the attachment goes from you know, mother in specific to, you know, girls in specific. He stays within the attachment to women. But now it changes more from attachment to the mother as specific to attachment to girls. But now, then he'll go into that, and then he'll get very absorbed in that and get married. So he's still in the conditioning that women will take care. But now he'll be a terrible husband because now all he knows is that just my mother always took care, the wife's going to always take care. So that means, according to his selfish desires, he's expecting the wife is going to take care of him. But now it's a different relationship. Mother is like, you know, 95%, 98% the mother does, and then 2% the kid responds. You know, basically it does things that he, you know, is supposed to. But with the wife, it's 50-50. So he's totally untrained. He'll make a disgusting, terrible grihastha. You know? And if one doubts this point, one just has to look at the Western culture, where you have I think 60 to 75% horse rate. You know, just as nobody knows how to act. So the Vedic cultures, the boys have to be taken out of this environment. And then they start to understand what's going on, who they are, how to deal with others, how to render service. Because in the house they do some service, but it's very much they expect respect return. They do something, you know, and then they expect a lot of praise for it. You know, they make all their faces and, you know, they're appreciated very much. But in here they have to learn to do service without all that, you know, reward, that material reward. Is that it's duty, you're supposed to do it. You're supposed to do this because you're supposed to do it. And there's a higher purpose to doing it. So they start to learn all this. Then, when they learn that and they're self-sufficient, then in the household ashram, they can do their duties, wife can do theirs. He understands his duties to take care of the wife and the children. Plus he's not attached to it. So he can be a leader, he can be guru. So he becomes the guru pati. Right? And the wife then, because she's trained properly in the same fashion, meaning that in the, that hers is done in the house. In the house, and the mother tells her all these different things and what her duties are and how you have to take care. So the girl starts to learn, starts as she grows up, starts to assist the mother in taking care of the house, taking care of the other children, taking care of, you know, the other men and guests in the house. All this, so she learns all that. So then she gets trained in that. She becomes Dharma Patni. She knows what is religion. And the boy knows what is, you know, the ultimate goal of life and the proper way of performing duty. Then it makes a very nice combination. Otherwise, the boy just grows up in the house. You can do that, but that's the education of shooters. It's not the education of Brahmins. It's not dvijas. Dvijas always go to the shudras stay at the home. Those are their attachment. They can't be in the system too much. They can't. So if being that the case, then the parents have to know what it is they have to get through to the kid that he would get in the gurukul. So the kid doesn't go to the gurukul, then the parents themselves have to know what they're supposed to teach, which means the philosophy, means the duties in the house, and all that. So now then the father wants to have to try to train the boy and teach him how he's got to start doing duties in the house. So he starts to learn to be dutiful. He starts to learn how to properly behave and act with the mother, not just demanding this and that. How to properly behave with other relatives and his sisters and his younger brothers, how to take care and all this. Then when he gets up, then if he gets married, then he has that understanding of Dharma, working and duty and all that. But, so one may say, well then, ultimately it comes the same. They both learn Dharma, so why do you have to go, why is it more advantageous to go to the Gurukul and the other one didn't? They got the same result. They're both learning the proper method of dealing. The difference will be is, the one who grew up in the house never knows how to deal outside of the house. He's totally dependent upon the house. He has no independence. Therefore, as life goes on, he can never leave the house. He's grown up in attachment, he'll live his life in attachment, and the end of his life, he'll be in the environment of attachment. When advances nicely in devotional service, one may be able to detach himself. But the easy, natural thing will be attachments of stay. But if one goes and trains under someone, then one sees that he can do on his own. He can wash his own clothes, he can clean his own room, he can live simply, he can depend upon Krishna for whatever he needs. He doesn't have to depend upon a whole family environment. Then in that way, he can remain independent, give that strong spiritual support for the wife and the children. Plus, at the end of life, then he can lead them, you know, into that solid spiritual path, and manaprastha, or take sannyas like that. Otherwise, he won't be able to. He may be able to do his dharma nicely, in the house, but it'll be very hard to lead the family on really strongly spiritually like that. He'll have to take a lot of support from others like that. So if one knows, one can do. Either path is there. They're both within Varnashram, they're both within human life. But it's just they both have their advantages and disadvantages. I mean, it's not an advantage. They both have their methods. They both have their methods. But one has to understand it. Just sentimentally just saying this and that, or well, my idea is this, it doesn't count. It's what's the Shastra's idea? What's the Sadhu's idea? What's Krishna's idea? So then that's the reality, that's just the way the modes of nature work. That's the point. If we understand it's the modes of nature that are working, then we should study and understand how the modes of nature work. That's why Krishna gives in here. He's pointed out, okay, we're supposed to work in detached work with knowledge. So now he's starting to get into what this knowledge really is. You know, the first six chapters, he's described nicely work and knowledge. He's given a very good understanding. But now he's getting right into the technicalities of what that means, you know, this knowledge. So here now he's pointed out how to separate the, or how to actually, what is, means the definition of knowledge, knowing the matter and spirit and the two kinds of spirit, and the relationship, and what is the process of this knowledge. Then, so that is knowledge. Then from there it goes on. And one point, he gets into the modes of nature, three modes of nature is the next chapter. Okay, now we've said everything's working in the modes. How do we understand the modes? How do they work? Right? Then he gets later into more detail, just all activities according to the modes. So you can even choose your activities. That way then you can situate yourself properly on this knowledge. So it works very nicely. Is this just that's the way the material nature is? That's all. We accept that and we do it. And if we say, oh, we don't care for that, means we don't actually accept that the material nature works the way she works. We think, I have another idea, I'm going to do it another way. Krishna is very clear, this is the system. And then if we understand that, then it makes life very easy. If we don't, it makes it very difficult. It's interesting. You know, again, those points, they separate, you have to take care of it. Chaitanya starts to explain Sanatana Goswami's knowledge. And he starts off with that, you know, so many living entities, and of that, very few are human. Of that, most are uncivilized, only a few are civilized. Civilized means follow Vedic culture. And from that, very few, you know, he just takes it up right through the whole process. So it's like, it's, just accepting the principle of the restrictions that go with the Vedic culture, and that we don't want to, because we don't understand relationships. The devotees. So we talk about, you know, we approach from the material side, you know, karmas and relationships, and be nice and try to understand the other. But what does that mean? It means there'll be restriction. If I have to understand, it means I have to let the other person talk. I can't talk all the time, so I'm restricted. Right? Then if you know, I have to consider them as an individual, then I have to consider what they like and don't like. What they like, I only do those activities. What they don't like, I avoid those. Right? So in this way, I can try to make marriage or friendship work. But I'm setting the rules and regulations, the restriction, or according to my own ideas or some other mundaner's ideas, rather than the Vedic system, which sets the restrictions, which creates the environment, which creates the role, like that. If I'm a friend, it means there's a restriction of what I do and what I don't do. Like that. Like if I'm a friend, it means it's more equal. So we work together, camaraderie is more and this and that. So we're restricted to that. I can't just go out and be totally dependent upon them and they gotta pay all my bills and this and that. That's a vatsalya relationship. Though then, you know, you may have friendship that's touched with that, but you can't even major that. Then it changes the relationship. The role changes. You know? But then if you do that, then you can't be equal with them. So it's like one gets the other. You know, the father's brother and the father's son. A different relationship. The roles. So what your facilities are and what your restrictions are, establish your role. Or the role is, put it the other way, the role establishes the restrictions. You want to be a father, then there's certain things you have to do and certain things you can't. You know, you want to be a mother, you want to be a son, you want to be a friend, you want to be a leader, you want to be a follower. Then the role restricts. Then you call it that. You know, you don't call someone a mother who's never at the house, who's always out sometime and this and that. You may say biologically you could call her a mother, but she's not performing the role of a mother. So if that's, you know, so therefore the whole idea of the Vedic system is the roles are there. The roles have been established by Krishna. In other words, rasa has been established by Krishna. So now Krishna establishes what are the facilities and the restrictions and all that for each role. So that's basically what we're looking at. Varnashram means, do we accept Krishna's definition of roles or do we accept our own? Like that. So it's just a matter of understanding what is Varnashram. We always just take it as rules and regulations because we don't like rules and regulations. But it's roles. And because of our impersonal background, we can't understand roles. It doesn't make any sense. If we have tasted roles, and we actually understand, we've either associated with persons or somehow or another been in a position where we actually have felt, we've had roles and that restricts our life and we do those things and we follow that as we're supposed to do it. Then Varnashram may easily and naturally make sense without much, you know, discussion. You just tell what are the things and one just does it. Because yes, I understand roles, I understand restrictions, I understand duties. If one hasn't had that experience, I mean, you can talk until the cows come home. And it just won't be understood. All that's seen is this restrictions. Why I can't do this? Yeah, well, you can do that, but it changes your role. And how many roles? You're just going to be someone with no roles. You know? Okay. So it's just, there was no roles and there's no relationship. Because there's no relationship, you get frustrated. And because we don't get happiness on that platform, then naturally we drop down to the next platform. I mean, we either have two directions we can go. We get no proper rasa in the material world and dealing with other people. We can go two directions. We can either go to try to leave the material world and establish spiritual relationships with Krishna and his associates, or we go down to the senses and just do what we like, what you know, how we perceive things, how we want to do with the material energy. You know, because there's only three platforms for exchange of roles. The spiritual, he's with Krishna and his devotees on the spiritual platform. Emotional, which is the platform of prescribed duties, Varnashram. and then his senses. So even in the material world, the best is the senses are in line with how the Vedic culture says to deal with the senses, because that then supports the roles. In other words, the senses support the mind. The mind is the main feature. So the mind is the seat of emotions. And then the senses support that. You know, like you have friendship, and then you may eat something together, but the eating is not the prominent feature. That's a support of the friendship. Because how you eat with your friend will be different than you eat with, you know, another relation, another rasa. So it's just supporting. But otherwise, we make that prominent. What we eat, how we eat, where we eat, when we eat, why we eat, that makes our position, that makes our role. You know, so what facility I got, you know, I mean, my position, you know, that makes everything for me. Not the relationships that position has with others. Just, I'm in that position, I get respect, I get facility, you know. I eat like this, because then that establishes, you know, what I want, but it doesn't establish relationships. So because of impersonal upbringing, then many times the difficulty comes in relating to actual roles and relationships that go along with it, and the duties and responsibilities and restrictions and you know, happinesses that go with it.
One experience we had in the West is that when we meet, like, my Prabhupada, who was a perfect guru, and he actually trained us how to become disciples, and we actually, you know, it was a complete change for us. But we tried to do it as best we could, but that relationship has established there, and we can't forget him for one day.
Mm.
All the time. It's such a nice relationship, because when we're forcing ourselves to do it, follow the perfect disciples who have perfect spiritual wisdom.
Mm.
The relationship is so sweet and strong that, you know, we never leave here for one.
Mm.
Never think of taking a day off or anything like that.
Mm.
It's completely nice relationship.
Yeah, that's interesting point, not taking a day off. You know, husband, you know, wife doesn't take a day off, or, you know, she's not anymore the wife, or husband, or children. Is there
so you can see it does work if you apply it.
It does work. If you apply it, it works very nicely. Just the point is because of our personal background, it's very hard to relate to these things and apply it. Prabhupada was so perfect and did all these things, it naturally invokes from us these acts. But then on our own, we don't necessarily always, it's hard for us to establish the others. If one's tasted that very nicely, then one can just expand on that. The principle is the same. The principle is the same. Just seeing the duties. Restrictions creates the rasa. Right? You know, the man doesn't go off with other women, then it creates a strong bond between husband and wife. It enhances the rasa. The man's off and the wife's off with other men or women, then it breaks down the relationship, because the role is not maintained. Like that. The kid doesn't listen to the parents, doesn't respect the parents. Then it breaks down, he's not following his role, so it breaks down the relationship between the parents and the child. It means the leader doesn't, you know, give shelter to that properly, he's not performing the role. It breaks down the relationship. Those who are following, they don't follow, they just do whatever they want. It breaks down the relationship with the leader. So it all comes back, it's all personal. That's when we say we're personalists, means we can take everything back to person. Which means everything comes back to relationship. You know, the soul is serving the Krishna. So that expands. So the soul is with other souls and their relationships in serving Krishna. You know? know, and then in the material world, because we have the attachments to the perverted reflections of those original relationships, then even those we still have to do according to Krishna's direction, because they're perversions of the reflection of the original. So still, because it's a reflection, still the rules are made by Krishna. So it's in that way, it's the principles. The philosophy of it, the principles are very easy, very straightforward. It's just a matter of accepting that, accepting to be restricted in that, what you have, what you don't have. So everybody has different restrictions and facilities. Like a brahmachari, he's restricted in sex life. But he's independent. He can come and go as he pleases when he likes, basically. He's here in this temple today. He decides to go, decides he's going to go to another temple. He just packs up and goes. Puts all his stuff in his bag, walks off, gone, finished. No obligation. So Grihastha cannot do that. Absolutely can't do that. He only has to get together money for one person. He can sleep anywhere, eat anything. Grihastha can't do that. He has to see that there's proper arrangements and proper food and all that, and pre-plan everything. Brahmachari hardly has to plan anything at all. However it happens, it's good enough. Grihastha can't do that. So where the brahmachari is free, Grihastha doesn't have. Grihastha would say, well, I've got my independence in another way. I don't have to necessarily do everything according to temple authorities. I live my life how I want, I dress how I want, I eat how I want. But then he's restricted. He has to raise the funds to get all those things. Right? If he raises his own funds, makes his own, then he has that independence. The brahmachari just eats what the temple gives him. But if that Grihastha is dependent upon the temple, then there is some restrictions because of that connection. He has to take only how much money the temple can give him. That will therefore restrict his facilities and what he does and how he does it. So when one wants all the independence how he wants, all the facility how he wants, and someone else has got to give it to him, that's where all the problem comes. Because we're not willing to accept the role and responsibility that goes with it. Brahmachari is free, independent, but he has to listen to authority. Brahmachari just does what he likes most here and there. He's not a brahmachari. He doesn't actually establish himself as a brahmachari. So he won't get that taste, and no one can relate to him. So he's not satisfied, others aren't satisfied. Grihastha neglects his family. The roles don't work properly there, but he'll also neglect everything else. If he neglects his family, he's going to neglect everybody else also. It's not that he'll neglect his family to be the most perfect temple president. No, he neglects everybody. Because he doesn't know the duty of taking care of people. So that's the principle. How to take care of dependents. He can't take care of wife and kids. He's not going to be able to take care of brahmacharis and others in the temple. This principle is a principle. Because from one, you can learn the other. If someone can train him in the one, he'll be able to do the other. If someone can come along and say, hey, you're not taking care of your temple devotees, and train him how to do that, and after a while he knows, hey, I'm not taking care of the wife and kids either. So all these things are very clearly delineated and for specific purposes. If people take them, it works very nice. If they don't take them, it's a mess. Guaranteed mess. Guaranteed mess. Money back guarantee.
Dita is actually it's perfect. Perfect way to live. Krishna is telling you a perfect.
He's perfect. It's a perfect system. is connected to Krishna and the material world, you know, it's only going to go only so good. But it's a perfect system. If one has faith in it, everything goes perfect. Perfect meaning, one is Krishna conscious, one is happy. That's the point, is to accept that it's a perfect system. Thank you.